I'm sorry. I can help you.
Yes.
First of all, you must have got our name from
David Porter.
David Porter's radio show, or did you call him?
His show.
His show, yeah. So you heard the show on September 25th.
A week ago.
Right. Well, tell me your reaction to the show.
I've heard him on the show several times, and I really enjoy listening to it. I think there are some strange ideas. I think there are some exciting ideas. I like McLuhan, and I think that's probably where the genesis of the ideas are coming from, McLuhan's hot-cold media business. And I specifically had a question about Ezra Pound.
Okay, well, that's great. What's your name, first of all?
My name is Jerry.
Jerry, where are you calling from?
Northridge.
Northridge, great. Is this the second time you've heard Bob?
Second time, mm-hmm.
Well, you can tell me the question. My name is Jerry also, by the way. Glad to know you.
Yes.
You can tell me the question, and I can make a note of it. But what I do recommend is calling on November 27th.
He's on the show again.
He's on the show again for 2.5 hours. And, in fact, we're playing a rare McLuhan interview for the first hour. And then for an hour and a half, Bob will be live again taking questions.
That sounds good. And that's November
27th, Saturday morning, 6 to 8:30 a.m.
Okay.
I recommend taping it as well because
I will.
As you can tell, with Bob's stuff, it's good to listen to it.
Several times. Maybe.
Several times, exactly. I've got lots of tapes of his 4 years on radio in Toronto, and I constantly listen to them. And as well, there's quite a few other tapes of various interviews and whatnot he's done throughout the country. Why don't you tell me, what is your question on Ezra Pound?
Well, I'm not really a student of Ezra Pound. I know very little about him. I know that he was in Italy during World War II. I think he was a pro-fascist, and I think he... I guess when the war ended, somehow he ended up in the United States, and apparently he was spent some time in a naval mental hospital or something up until nearly when he died. From what I understand, that might be wrong, but I was wondering if Reverend Bob has any idea about how he got in that mental hospital, why he was incarcerated, what was going on there. I'm a little bit familiar with some esoteric government goings on, like MK Ultra and things like that. And I'm wondering if he was being silenced for his radical ideas, or was it a political thing, or was he truly nuts?
That's a great question. I hope you do indeed call up.
Can I call and maybe ask that question?
And ask that question.
Sure.
985-5735 is the number. That's 818.
Mm-hmm.
At KPFK.
Okay.
And that's a very good question. I've heard some theories on that before. The one book I'd recommend right off the bat is The Pound Era by Hugh Kenner.
Mm-hmm.
That may not go specifically into what you're talking about, but it could inform you more on Pound, because this was the probably the most famous ex-McLuhanite, Hugh Kenner, who wrote it. In fact, Hugh Kenner is one of the better literary critics, and has written a lot on Joyce as well, and Beckett. And Bob constantly recommends The Pound Era.
Mm-hmm. Also, now that you were talking, I was thinking about Lyndon LaRouche. He made some remarks about LaRouche. I'm a little bit as informed on LaRouche as I am about Pound, which means not much. But what are Reverend Bob's views on LaRouche? I couldn't make out if he was for him or against him, or kind of both and neither.
That second is more correct, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Bob is for and against Well, he tries to have suspended judgment, so I guess that's wrong. He's not for or against. He believes that everyone has something to offer, and doesn't discount people by sometimes their bad reputation. LaRouche does not have a good reputation in America, and often people are turned off by Bob just because he mentions LaRouche. So, it's interesting. I mean, LaRouche put out a telephone-sized booklet on Iran-Contra like a year or two after it happened, and then 10 years later, all the biggies like Noam Chomsky or Perenni or the leftist political researchers were saying this was a horrible thing that happened, but they sort of discount LaRouche's, you know, jump on it all.
Although he was ahead of everyone.
He was ahead of everyone. And, I mean, that's just one example. Some of the things LaRouche says are really far-fetched and mind-blowing, and people just can't relate. And I think if you see any of his newspapers, I'd recommend picking them up. You know, they're often at airports or the New Federalist or the EIR or 20th Century is a science magazine. They're worth checking out. Just like I think Farrakhan's papers and the Spotlight and all these papers are worth checking out. And I'm not saying everything they say is absolutely correct and everything they say is absolutely wrong. I think Bob picks this up from some of the other people he's studied, especially Mae Brussel. She would... Are you familiar with her at all?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. She would as well try to read 10 newspapers a day and many, many books. So, to ask his particular opinion on LaRouche is another good question. Again, it's really important how you word your question. So that one, I like how you worded the pound question, but the LaRouche question, sure, I think that's a very valid thing to ask Bob to comment on because it is something that's a bit controversial and I think worth pursuing, especially for like the KPFK listeners, because I think probably the majority of them think LaRouche is horrible.
Well, that's probably true that they think that. Although I agree with you, I've read some of his papers. He put out something when that AIDS initiative was on the ballot. I guess his group was promoting that, and some of the things that he wrote about, and this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, was poo-pooed as nonsense then, but now it's becoming. It seems to be recognized as at least plausible. And or regarded as true, some of the things that he was saying, like the transmission vector of insects as being a possible route for AIDS infection, it was disregarded then. Although I don't think that chance is zero now that they've looked at the situation, especially with Belgrande, Florida, wherever that is in Florida, where people are coming down with AIDS and they don't know what the vector is. So
right. Right.
Anyway, I'll be sure to listen and tape it, call up, I'll ask a couple questions.
Oh, that's really good. Now, do you have a paper and pencil? Because I'll also give you my name and address.
Sure.
Why do you call Bob Reverend?
I associate him somehow with the Church of the Subgenius.
And what do you know about them?
Oh, I've purchased a few books. I think they're a scream. I think it's a brilliant satire on humanity's addiction to religion.
And right. So you've got Book of the Subgenius and Three-Fisted Tales or High Weirdness?
Not High Weirdness, although I've seen that.
Yeah.
Not Three-Fisted Tales, but the one before that. Yeah.
You have Book of the Subgenius.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen their video, Arise?
Yes. It's great.
Yeah.
Great satire.
We're also going to be showing a video in Venice at the Pixel Festival of Bob talking about Finnegan's Wake for It's about 17 minutes.
Will that be detailed in your papers you'll send me?
I will send you information about that then.
Great.
If you're interested.
I've got to go now, but thank you very much, Jerry.
Thanks for calling, Jerry. I appreciate you giving us your reaction.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Time will be 2:45:50.
Hi, Carolyn.
Yes?
This is Jerry.
Yay!
Woo! How's it going?
Pretty good. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Apparently everyone celebrates down here. It's no big deal in Canada.
Oh, it's a big deal here.
I can't believe it.
I bake a bird every year. It's so fun.
Oh, right. I remember you saying. Oh, this is great.
So is Bob there?
No, he's still in Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia?
Yeah, he went to the funeral.
He went to...
funeral.
To Garrett's funeral?
Yeah.
Is he going to be back? When?
Who, Bob?
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
Oh, good. Because this is the number David will call for the radio show.
That's right. It's on Saturday, yeah.
He knows that now.
Oh, yeah. He said, I have to be sure and be back and be rested and ready for my fans.
All right.
But he had an amazing... Well, from what I've heard, I haven't flown much because I had to go to Florida while... He was in Nova Scotia.
Yes.
And he says it's just amazing. He got to go into Garrett's house, even though it's locked up and sealed and nobody knows what's going on, he happens to befriend the guy who turns out to be his closest relative. And this guy gave him 2.5 garbage bags of Garrett's letters.
Oh, my God, that's wonderful.
And I don't know if he's bringing them or what, but it's just like, you know, one of the holy offices, and Bob comes along and everything falls at his feet. I just can't believe it. I was adding up all the holy offices. Like, we went by May, we went to May's house, and we ended up, you know, seeing her die. And then
right.
Going through her whole house and helping them box up her
right.
books. And, I mean, on and on and on. It's just every holy office, Bob, ends up, you know.
I know. Bob helped me with the Zappa files.
Yeah. Which, it's amazing.
Yeah, which you got to hear the great news. I can't listen to Bob's tapes driving to North Hollywood every morning anymore.
Why?
Because they laid me off.
Why? Laid you off?
That is the coolest. I am just so ecstatic, and everybody's going, aren't you sad? And I'm like, joyous.
We knew it would happen.
I know it. They laid me off because they said cutbacks.
I don't believe it.
Isn't it a trip? And on 11/22, Dottie called me.
Called you.
I was like, late, is sort of in the evening, I was about to go to bed. She said, Jerry, we got to lay you off. I says, oh, okay, I'll come and get my stuff tomorrow. Okay, thanks, bye. I mean, it was amazing. And
wow.
It's so healthy for me. I mean,
oh,
you know.
Yeah, that's great, because it was so hard for you to decide. It's like, you didn't want to disappoint them, but, you know,
right.
Here's if they're assholes. Oh, that's right. Amazing.
Isn't that amazing? On 11/22.
Yeah. And did they ever find out that you were working for Carolyn?
I don't know, you know. And there's a relative, Midget's wife, Susan, who's working there and sort of was helping do my job. So it was like someone was already trained. And her hours were cut in half. So I don't think they're lying that it was cutbacks. And, you know, I just feel sort of weird because Gail or Frank never called me and says, oh, thanks for dedicating 9.5 years of your life and blah, blah, blah. So
after the letter that your father wrote.
Right. But it's like, you know, whatever. I'm happy moving on. And it just the things that have happened since then are amazing. I'm going to write you guys a letter. I'm composing of all kinds of updates because there's so much to tell you. But since my budget's lower now, I'm going to cut it a little short. But there was a couple things that I wanted to tell Bob, but you got to pass this one on.
Okay.
At the Pixel Fest, we showed Holeopathic Mark K.
Yeah.
You know that the 17-minute video of Bob talking about Finnegan's Wake for Bob's.
Right.
Yes. Had a great attendance, over 100 people from San Diego to San Francisco coming. And Ned left within 22 seconds and said, why are you exposing people to this? Because, you know, the sound is so intense, especially in a studio, it was just bouncing off the walls. So that was like deeming it a masterpiece immediately. And then, you know, I didn't know how the audience was taking it because, you know, it was a big crowd. And after 17 minutes, they roared in applause.
No.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, I thought they would be because they're very fussy audience. From that point on, they would, you know, get up and move and be restless if they, you know, because they see the running time. But
you put Holeopathic Ron K on first.
First, because I always like to put a long one on first and get it over with. And it's just sort of always been the tradition to do the Bob thing first because I show the Bob Media Ecology videos before, you know, and give the announcement, this is why I started, and that was great. And Tracy and Mike, the two kids that Bob met at the Leary, they attended, and they loved it, too. She said, I was laughing through the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, that is so neat. Good.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, and then the Garrett news, that was the real heavy thing.
Well, when that the way Sue told us, we didn't know until the Saturday when we met her at her hotel.
Right.
We were sitting in the New York Palace looking down from like the 17th floor, maybe the 22nd floor, she had 22 in her room number, onto St. Peter's Cathedral.
Oh, my God.
50th or whatever. And looking down, this, you know, smack dab in the middle, we looked down, and then the three of us were sitting on the window seat, and Sue said, yeah, I went in and lit a candle for Garrett today. And we said, yeah, you know, that's good. Because we all know, I mean, we never thought Garrett would die, but we all know he's a candle lit. But then she looked at us and she said, Garrett died on Monday.
Yeah.
We all applauded and said, good for him, he's fine.
You guys are great. Yeah, that is amazing.
So we had a wake. We stayed overnight with her at her hotel, and she had gotten some beer and some niblets, and we had a wonderful evening talking about Garrett and talking to him and, you know, wishing him on his way.
That's great, because she called me and asked me to send the tapes, so I sent her.
Yeah,
I have
thanks you so much for that.
Did she get them?
She got them.
Oh, great, because I sent her three, and it was so fun reviewing them, and you won't. I mean, that is, you know, knowing that he died and then the next day putting that tape on, it was just so moving.
Oh, wow. Because
it was just like he was there. He's just there in my car when I'm driving and listening to that.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Oh, that was so intense. But the one thing is I always did want to meet him in person, you know, and I envisioned driving, you know, there someday. But
well, you know, he was really deteriorating. Bob and I were kind of glad we saw him when he was a little more put together because, you know, his pictures now, he's just...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's really sad to see someone who... I mean, we saw him in better times, so, yeah. You know, it was okay for us.
So how did Bob react to the Stang article in the...
You wouldn't have believed... I was reading or something, and he was just beside me reading. He was laughing and laughing.
He loved it, man. Stang, 8 pages, a page and a half dedicated to Bob.
That should tell you something.
That is so amazing. And the other thing is, you know, the Bob Dobbs, Stang Bob Dobbs picture with the pipes, the four pipes coming out of his head,
yes.
And he has a third eye that is in your, you know, my other room, where the room that you guys stayed in.
Uh-huh.
I blew it up, and I made this big sign, Bob Dobbs on KPFK.
No.
And I ride, yeah, it's great, because I ride around down to the beach, and people have stopped me in the car. They, you know, it's on my bike, and they go, yeah, Bob Dobbs. I said, here, you want a flyer? And one of the creators of the church, Satellite Weaver, his wife stopped me. This is just on my bike, where you can only see the top of it. Said, oh, my husband helped start that church. Oh, well, here's a flyer. Bob's going to be on the radio. Oh, okay, thanks. And people come by constantly at the beach, and just, I mean, I've met some amazing folks because of it. And that's why I got to get down to the beach, because these are my last 2 days to keep it out. But I know it's like, if Stang found out, he would be so pissed. And I even wonder what Bob thinks of me doing that. But I just thought it would be a neat experiment.
And Bob wouldn't care.
I know. That's just it. It's just like such a great way. And I mean, there's so many. This one kid came by and said that Bob Dobbs saved him from Christianity. I says, well, tune on in, and here's the flyer with the information. And I've been giving the flyer to, I gave the flyer to Jackson Brown at this art thing.
Uh-huh.
And we went to Fireside Theater the other night, and they came into the audience. And
I gave, you handed them a flyer?
I handed them a flyer, and they looked at it and then just threw it up in the air. It was like, it was fabulous.
It's, oh, that's great. What was the name of the lady? Weaver?
Satellite Weaver is the one of the artists
that
are in the book prominently. And his wife just says, oh, yeah, we started this. So I says, well, Bob's going to be on the radio. And she didn't even sort of, like, look at me weird, like, well, there isn't a Bob, you know?
Oh, I know. It's like people believe it now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's time for there to be a Bob.
I know it.
Or it's like, you know, there was, you know, a vacuum.
Exactly.
People want the vacuum filled. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, and I had duping problems with my cassette, but I was sort of waiting for Corbin's tapes to arrive. But I'm going to send you guys the tapes of the reactions last show.
Right. We were waiting on that.
I know, and then the reactions on this show too.
Yeah. So both together. Yeah.
You'll get a big, huge package soon.
Right.
And.
Yeah, and I will send you some money for the tapes. What I'll do is just send you $20, and you can put that towards all the tapes you've been sending.
Oh, great. No problem. That's cool.
Yeah.
It's my pleasure, man. And I sent it to Nelson. Did he... Because Nelson got the whole pack, and then... And I don't know if... He never reacted to me, so I don't know if he reacted to Bob.
I don't know. He was phoning here, and... kept missing Bob and went.
Oh, because he went to the Kennedy thing.
He went to the Kennedy thing, and he's back.
Yeah,
he's back now. But the other day before he went to the Kennedy thing, he was phoning me at the lab and here. So finally, I just gave him Sue's number, and apparently he phoned at Sue's, and Sue and Bob and Nelson were on the phone from like 12 midnight until 4 a.m.
Wow. That's great.
Nelson was downloading some information there, I'll tell you.
So, of course, everybody constantly asks, how's your project going?
It's going amazing.
Oh, good.
We've hit a new level of interaction with this guy that I sent you that article on, the super...
Right, the guy from New York Magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy, he figures his theory can explain the technique that we're doing.
Oh,
so it's one of these things where that might just be the key to getting this thing moving.
Right.
Having a theory behind it.
Right.
So it's pretty exciting.
That's good. That's good news.
Yeah.
So I can just tell people there's been good advancements.
Yeah. Things, yeah, really. And I'm just having a blast in the lab making all these remedies. It's just amazing.
Oh, that's great. So basically, you guys look like you're staying here at this address and keep for a while. And,
that's right.
Oh, good.
That's right. I mean, I'm starting to move around, but I had a really nice trip to Florida, down to Sarasota.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and it was, you know, partly work, but it was mostly just so much pleasure, and I'm meeting sort of the network of people we'll be working with, and oh, I just, it's like I'm in heaven, you know, because I've always sort of wanted the camaraderie of working with a team of people, and I'm finally getting it, because basically when I'm in New York, I'm in the lab by myself, which I love too.
Right.
You know, because I can really get some, you know, real solid work done.
But you still have a support system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just amazing, really amazing people, and it was interesting because Sue was telling us of the gnashing of teeth and beating of breasts in Dartmouth, Halifax, because of Garrett dying.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of, you know, group of people who were really close to Garrett. And I said to her right away, I said, well, you know, they're just going on and on because they've only met one amazing person in their life.
Right.
And they think that's it. You know, they'll never look for anyone else because they think Garrett's it. Whereas, you know, Sue, Bob, you know, we go out and we meet more and more.
Constantly.
All the time.
I know. I met an avant...
Don't limit yourself.
I know. I met an avant-garde playwright the other day. And it fit it so perfect because one friend of mine called me an avant-garde archivist. So I said, I've got to interview you because I'm an avant-garde archivist. And he goes, great. And I says, have you ever read Finnegan's Wake? And he goes, well, you can't read Finnegan's Wake. And that's like the key answer. If you say that, you're in my book, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he's totally into the Wake and can talk about it. So.
Oh, that's great. Well, actually, one thing about this guy, that Dardic guy who invented this super wave theory.
Right.
When I talked to him the other day, because I've just recently met him on the phone, and when I talked to him, I started throwing in some McLuhan stuff. He says, McLuhan, oh my gosh, isn't that amazing? That's the guy that gave me my first impetus to get into this work.
Amazing.
I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly, 1979, by Marshall McLuhan. It was a reprint. And he said some things that made me think of this, and I decided to pursue it.
Amazing.
When I heard that, and they'd already known about Bob and McLuhan and wanted to, this Dardic guy wanted to meet Bob. But Bob said, it's just another theory. He doesn't know this, that, and the other thing. And finally, when I told Bob in Nova Scotia that Dardic said, well, that's where he got his first insight, and Bob says, okay, I've been gathering ammunition for 20 years, and I intend to use it.
Yee-hoo!
No, I mean, I expect, the doctor that got us in touch with this Dardic, you know, they all expect Bob and I to be blown away, but Dardic doesn't know what he's in for. He doesn't know that Bob's going to blow his ass off.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, I miss you guys both. It's been fun here. Fiocca's Funny Farm has a new resident for a while. This Linda Alley, she's about 25-year-old wonderful lady from North Carolina, raised in Miami, real street smart, and she's a French horn player.
Oh, my God.
And she's trying to do her thing in L.A., and it's been fun. And I think because she gets the budget rate like you guys, I think we're going to have Paige and Jeff move back in, too. So there's going to be four of us here. Because why not? It's going to be a great, and, you know, all my stuff's breaking down, and Paige wants to come back here and get a job, so I'm saying, well, you guys might as well, because she'll be off in a couple weeks with her nanny job, so it'll just be me, Jeff, and Linda.
Oh, yeah.
So it's,
she'd be staying with the...
Yeah, she'll stay wherever she ends up working. But it's been a riot. And then Dave was here. He did a seminar on Kennedy from 10:30 in the morning till past midnight.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was so great at a wonderful place called the Grassy Knoll. Coffee house bookstore.
Yeah. I read that. That was amazing because that gave him a good long time to really develop everything.
It was really incredible, and it was good.
How many people showed up?
About 75 to 100 over the whole day, and about 15 people did the entire all day.
Wow.
So it was a good turnout, and it was pretty much a success, and it was good to have Dave here. So.
Oh, that's great.
So we're always
good for you and
cooking along.
Yeah, use your time off well.
Oh, God, tell me about it. I want to sit and relax, and I can't. My schedule's just...
Yeah, you'll be wondering in a few days, how could I have done two jobs? Because I know, the time fills right up.
Yeah, and the great thing is Phil and I have developed the greatest relationship. We go on these long bike rides, like, every Saturday night, and we go to jazz every Friday, and he's just such a wonderful friend, and I definitely know he'd say hello to both of you.
Give him my best.
Yeah.
I always think of him when I come across an article or whatever, and I just wish I had more rollerblading classes with him.
Yeah, all right. Carolyn, it was really nice talking to you.
Yeah, great to talk to you, and I'll tell Bob, and maybe he'll get off his ass and give you a call one of these days.
Well, it's all right. I mean, I just wanted to confirm this is the number for David to call him, and it'll be fun for an hour and a half Saturday. I can't wait. I think it's going to be a good...
having just been down at Garrett's, I don't know. I mean, we've already played Garrett. Have you decided on what the first...
Oh, yeah, the first hour they're playing the McLuhan with Edwin Newman. So a lot of people are going to be tuning in, I think.
So. Okay, great. Good, real good talk.
Hugs and kisses, Carolyn.
Kisses, sweetie.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello?
Hi. Were you just, I'm sure, I don't know whether this is the right number, but were you...
This is the right number.
Oh, yeah. You were just on radio?
No, I wasn't, but I can give you any information you need to know.
Oh, okay. I'm really interested in turning off TVs and starting little neighborhood things.
Okay. Well, we can't do it like a smoke out. You know, you can't do like a no smoking day. What you need to do is talk about it to the point where everyone knows that this is what we have to do. It can't just be a little group of people. It has to be talked about immensely so that it's naturally going to happen. It can't be just a percentage. It can't be 50%. It has to be 100%, everybody. So what I suggest, and I'm really glad you called, is first of all, if you have a paper and pencil, I'll give you some information.
Okay?
Okay?
I do?
Yeah, now tell me what exactly is behind your emphasis on this idea.
I think the values of our human society have been infiltrated with some really probably commercialism is part of it, and bad taste. And I think our instead of I'm sure that some of the technology that he spoke about is going to bring thinking to a higher level, and I think it'll be higher than we've ever known it could be. But at the same time, with all the media that comes through our televisions in bad taste, I think it's deteriorating the essence of human dignity. How's that sound?
That sounds good, but you do realize that's very good, Carol, but do you realize, like, what Bob said is that media is extensions of us?
Yes.
So isn't the way it is.
All I remember is studying public access in 1973 in Hawaii. And when we started that, we were only allowed to start it because the Federal Communications said, look, we have to have some, we agreed to have the permission to cable only if we let you guys have this extension. That was kind of what you're talking about. I think the TV that has come to us hasn't certainly been just public access.
Right, right. That you believe there is an establishment, a business, a rich ruling class that's running the media.
And because sex and crime and all these things are human nature wants to hear about, oh, gosh, you know, what happened now? That type of thing, I think there's more of it. And, yes, extension, I hear what you're saying. It is an extension of us. But
right, because we're basically
an extension of one part.
Right, and we're basically not anti-technology. When he says turn off the TV, he's not anti-TV.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about studying the effects of
I'm
TV.
I'm a computer teacher.
Right, because we just turned TV and electricity on, and we never stopped and studied the effects.
Yeah.
So that's basically what he's talking about.
But
so,
I mean, when I think I lived in Tonga, where I totally lived as a human being.
Right.
See television for months. And
you did not see television for months.
I didn't see television
right.
for months. And it was a very, very beautiful part of my life.
That's great.
But I can honestly say that my life now, I mean, I came back to America having been away for 10 years thinking that, oh, I'd never be like the average American. They watch too much TV and they're so into malls and things like that. But I've been back for 10 years, and I'm getting to be just like everybody else.
Yep,
we are a product of our environment, aren't we?
That's right. And I think the most important thing you can do is do just what you're doing, is participate by calling me. And when you get this information, talk to other people about it.
Okay, I'll call you again because your line should be free for other people because they all just got your number.
You have my number. Call me anytime. I appreciate it.
Okay, and my name's Carol Kadura.
Okay, yes. Carol.
Bye.
Bye.
What's your name?
Jerry.
Jerry.
You can just send the ad to my attention, Jerry.
Okay.
All right.
Great, bye.
Bye. Hello?
Yes, is this Bob?
No, it isn't, but I can give you information about Bob. My name is Jerry. What's yours?
My name's Cynthia.
Hi, Cynthia. And did you listen to the show this morning?
Yes, I did.
What did you think?
I thought he was fabulous. It just seemed to connect with a lot of my own ideas.
What are some of the particular ideas that he connected with?
Well, I don't know. Is this a survey?
Well, we're just trying to communicate here. You don't need to answer any of the questions if you don't want.
Right. I mean, I just got a little bit cynical until now, seeing what it is I liked. But when I heard it, it almost makes me think that they have an agenda.
It sounds like Bob has an agenda?
No. It sounds that he may, I don't know. I'm just wondering, is he looking for validation on his ideas, or does he just want some kind of bouncing board to see what's out there? I mean,
We're just trying to basically get in touch with the listening audience, so it's not really a survey or an agenda. No, he really doesn't have an agenda, but in essence, it goes like this. He has an agenda and he doesn't have an agenda. He's often said that his dogma changes every 15 seconds. So, the reason you may have called is because you want more information in printed form, which I can supply for you, no problem. Do you have a pencil and paper?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The name of the book that Bob has published is called Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Do you know what phatic communion is?
No, I don't.
It's like if you had a flat tire and you were fixing it on the side of a road.
How do you spell his last name?
His last name is spelled D-O-B-B-S.
And
First of all, you can't get the book through bookstores. The information on how to get his book, you'll be able to get if you send me the self-addressed stamped envelope.
Oh, so he published his own book.
Self-published book. His CDs are available through Tower or any music stores, and the first CD, Bob's Media Ecology, and the artist is listed as Producers for Bob, has liner notes that are written by Bob that are as well essential listening. But don't you want to know what phatic communion is, or no?
Go ahead.
Okay. So if you were on the side of the road with flat tire, and you were fixing it, and I came up to you, and I said, hey, you got a flat tire? Well, it's evident you have a flat tire. You're fixing it, but you're probably not going to jump at me and go, yeah, can't you see it? You're just going to go, yeah. So it's just a social communication. And have you ever read Marshall McLuhan?
No, we haven't.
That's another person I would suggest you checking out. He has about 8 books in print. All of the titles you'll get if you send me self-addressed stamped envelope. Those books you can get at any good bookstore in town. Their stocking on the shelves are The Medium is the Massage, Understanding Media, and Laws of Media. Those are 3 of the books I would suggest checking out a little. And I would also suggest checking out the book by James Joyce entitled Finnegan's Wake. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, that's another one I would suggest. Because Bob will be back on January 22nd, and I would encourage you to tune in again and participate if you want. You know, we always take calls from the listeners. And
so you're at KPFP yourself?
I co-produce some of the shows on David's Genesis of the Music.
Oh, okay. So you were the guy on the radio?
No, that was David Porter.
Oh, okay. But you're affiliated with that particular program?
I am.
You're also involved with Bob Dobbs?
Yeah. Hey, you should work here. You're asking a lot of good questions. So, what is it? What do you think it was that attracted you to... Did you hear the whole show? Did you hear the McLuhan at the first hour?
No, I was listening to that Pasadena radio station earlier.
So you got caught about the last...
I caught about half of the show. And, I think that, you know, I guess as any... As a teacher might not want to comment on some of his... Or if you were at a public gathering, you're sort of a little bit concerned about how your words might be taken because you know that once you make a comment, it's not in a vacuum and it's going to change the dynamics of the entire discourse. And at this point, I don't want my comments to influence, you know, the direction he's taken because I think he's doing fine on his own.
Oh, I see. But it's not that. It's just that...
In the right direction.
Yeah.
And it's what you're saying is real creative, so I wouldn't want to thwart that process.
You know, I see.
By putting another spin on it. But
For you, you found ideas that were accessible for you to apply?
Well, I'm not really looking for, you know, a real dogma, you know, to apply. I'm interested in the ideas. I think they're interesting.
What do you watch TV?
I never used to, but just recently I haven't been feeling too well, and so I've been watching a lot of TV just in the last week.
Do you watch the talk shows, or?
I just got back from San Francisco, and I've been really upset about how my trip went and the fact that I had to come back to California.
Uh-huh.
So since then, I've just been dating myself with massive doses of television.
So anything episodic or
so actually tearing myself away this point from the TV to listen to the radio was quite an accomplishment.
Right.
So,
but is it all types or is it like talk shows or episodes?
No, I listen to a lot of talk shows. I really enjoy talk shows. No, I don't enjoy them actually. I think there's a lot of trash out there, and it just seems like a medium that could be utilized.
Because, see, that's the point that people miss sometimes that Bob is saying, is that he's saying turn off the TV, but he's not saying it because TV is bad. He's saying it because TV, like all media, has services and disservices.
Right.
And what we've never learned, really, is the effects of TV. And that's what we need to do. As soon as it came on, it's never been turned off. We need to turn it off for 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months and study the effects and then turn it back on.
Yeah, I was one that I never watched. I usually don't ever watch television unless I'm in some kind of personal crisis.
Right.
At which moment I will turn it on, and that's sort of my drug of choice.
That's your drug of choice.
Right.
Yeah. So you said you were a teacher?
No, I'm not a teacher.
Oh.
Becoming a teacher, but no, I'm actually a city planner.
Oh, I see.
So is he affiliated with any schools or universities?
No. He's an independent thinker, pretty much. I mean, his school would be Finnegan's Wake, Marshall McLuhan, May Brussel. Many of the people...
Is he a local Southern California?
No.
Teacher?
No, he isn't. He had a radio show in Toronto for 4 years. And we're trying to, well, we have them on every other month on KPFK.
Yeah, I think it'd be great to have them on if you could find a spot for them. But I would be interested in asking him how he feels the entire electronic media community or world, reality as he calls it, would play or does play out in places like Berkeley, where, you know, I spent about 6 months. I grew up in the Bay Area, actually. But just after, I just went back to do a few projects, work on a couple of projects for the city of Berkeley, and I was just amazed at just the amount of functions that different events to attend, but you couldn't possibly go to all of them, attend any of them.
Well, that's much like L.A. We just got a...
Well, not really. I mean, L.A.
Well, we got a cultural mecca. It just depends on what your interest is. Most of
people... Well, I mean, L.A. is, you know, Hollywood.
I tend to disagree if you...
I have friends that lived in L.A. for, like, since about 10 years, and some, I've missed other people that are just, like, born and raised in L.A., and it just doesn't have... You don't have that same counterculture culture or... diversity, nothing compared to Berkeley in San Francisco. Believe me, I was just there, and I grew up on the peninsula, and so I left there when I was 18 to go to school out here.
So were you raised listening to KPFA, the Pacifica sister station up there?
Yeah, I was not raised, but just, you know, listened to it as a kid, and my mom, my dad, really didn't like a lot of TV and stuff, so we didn't do a lot of that. But there was so much to do. I mean, it's a totally different atmosphere. I mean, there's a real sense of community out there. And I grew up in a kind of neighborhood where it was just parenting. I could go into anyone's house, and I was always welcome there. And there was always a place for me there. And there was always something going on in the neighborhood.
Right. You're talking about more a sense of community.
Right. Well, no, not so much that. I'm talking about just an incredible amount of cultural resources that are in the Bay Area. I mean, just in Berkeley and San Francisco. I mean, you've got so many just so much going on. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you've got in the city, you've got the things. But there's so many different little districts and communities and things, niches you can be a part of. You've got, you know, the Valencia district, you've got Noe, you've got, there's just so many areas, and each one has something distinct to offer. And that's totally excluding Berkeley. I mean, you go to Berkeley and you get blown away, you can listen to Gary Snyder. And people like Noam Chomsky and Gary Snyder always do the rounds in, you know, Berkeley.
Well, that's where I think...
Well, it's not that I'm lecturing, I was in Berkeley, I was just in the city, and I went to listen to, she was just incredible, and you've got it's just a great place to be. And I'm just wondering how the electric media. I don't believe that there's. I mean, yes, there's things going on like CD ROM, and if anything, there's people sitting there, there's computers and accessing information that way. But TV doesn't have the impact that it does out here. Not, I mean, to begin with, because this is, you know, Hollywood. I mean, you're living in that kind of place.
Well, let me just tell you one thing. I don't mean to disagree with you, but I saw Gary Snyder 2 weeks ago in Santa Monica. Noam Chomsky speaks here at least once a year.
Well, Gary Snyder's from the Bay Area.
Right. Well, he's going to speak.
Noam Chomsky's a professor at Cal Berkeley.
Right, but you're saying that Berkeley, that the Bay Area has so all this culture event. If you monitor Phoenix Bookstore, Mandala Bookstore, Bodhi Tree, you're going to get access, and all the colleges in L.A., you're going to get access to the same sort of cultural activities that the Bay Area offers. So, you know, and in fact, you've got a big advantage right here. We haven't gotten Bob on KPFA in Berkeley yet, and they have a Subgenius show up there, and they should be broadcasting Bob. And they haven't, so you got an advantage right there. But, I mean, I'm not trying to say it as though there's a race that one town's better than the other. I think it doesn't matter where you are, you can see.
I'm not saying this because, you know, I've grown a taste for Southern California, as much as I hate to admit it. And so it's not that I'm biased, but let me tell you, just right off the bat, go to the Bay Area, and I'm not kidding, because I hadn't been there as an adult, after college, because I got there when I was 18, that's about 7 years ago, and so I really, you know, you're just into your neighborhood, and you're just really anchored into the place you grew up, and so I really wasn't, and besides, I didn't grow up in the city, I grew up on the peninsula, and so I didn't really know what the city had to offer. I hadn't been so much of a part of it as I was when I went back as an adult, and I was there 4 months, and just right off the bat, you have, let let me tell you, do you know how many alternative newspapers are published in that city? It's impossible to read them all. It's impossible. Let me tell you, I lived in San Francisco, and I took BART into Berkeley because they really have a lot of different incentives against driving. And so it was outrageous. Like, I'd have to pay like $200 a month to park in Berkeley, so it was just easier to take BART. And so one of the biggest distribution points for a lot of these alternative newspapers was the BART station. So early in the morning, we'd, you know, pick up whatever stuff was out there to be picked up. And let me tell you, every single morning, there is a different alternative newspaper out there to be picked up, filled with events, okay, filled with events. And it was just, and this was just some of the mass distribution papers. I'm not talking about the little, every neighborhood in the city distributes their own community newspaper, okay? There's probably about eight different small neighborhoods in the city. Eight major districts in the city. You're talking about, you know, Noe, you're talking about the Mission, you're talking about the Marina, and each one publishes their own weekly community newspaper. It was filled with events and issues of interest to that specific and particular community. So, yeah. I mean, it's impossible to even read all of the news. I am an avid reader. I really get into reading these alternative newspapers, and just especially on BART. But I couldn't even, you know, I really didn't have a lot going on in my life. I'm not a mother of three, you know, and I wasn't, you know, doing the whole bit. And I couldn't read all of these papers.
Well, there's Marina Del Rey has the Argonaut. Citywide, there's the Reader, the Weekly, Chain Links, Village View. It's heavily extensive in L.A. as well.
I know, but...
And each community has its own paper.
Does it?
Sure. What area town do you live in?
I live in Laguna. I don't live in L.A. I live in Fort Smith.
Well, that's why. Behind the orange curtain, as they say. I mean, but you have a few. You have a few colleges down there, and actually, you got a good bookstore in Laguna.
We have a few good books.
Yeah, see, that's what Gary Snyder said, and that's the important thing: is that the bookstore is the center of the community. That's where you can exchange ideas. So I think it's bookstores that you need to go.
I mean, it's San Francisco. I've got this fabulous bookstore. If you're in the city, go to Modern Times.
I know. City Lights, Modern Times. There's
Modern Times is like. I mean, City Lights is established, and it's almost, you know, it's very much an institution, and there's a certain, you know, threat.
Well, take a little short jog north and go to Santa Monica, and there's three bookstores you can go to and spend.
I know, and I go...
Phoenix, Mandala, and Midnight Special.
Now, which is the one that's owned by the woman who owns Sisterhood?
That's Books on the Edge. That's the fourth one in Santa Monica. So you got four right in Santa Monica within a mile.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's just, I mean, you have a lot. I don't know. It's really, I mean, have you spent a lot of time? See, I'm sort of like by California. You know, I'm not by California. I'm by California. Grew up in the north. Lived in the south as an adult, you know, most of my adult life. Went to college here. Went to work here. And my best friends live and have lived in L.A. all their lives, and they're very active in what's going on in L.A., but it's, you know, really, I'm not saying this because I'm biased. I'm saying it because I was just completely snowballed by the alternative media press and the different events, literary, just any, whatever you're into, it's there. I mean, and it's almost too much. It's almost as though, so I'm just wondering what, you know, what Bob Jones would have to say about that in a place like Berkeley where...
Versus L.A.?
Excuse me?
You mean you want his opinion on L.A. versus Berkeley?
I want his opinion on what does he think about a place like, you know, Berkeley and even, you know, San Francisco where the media has, where the alternative media is so well entrenched and it has so many resources available and it really has a willing audience. It has, where the main media is not really something that, I mean, no one really, you know, sits and listens to, puts a lot of creed on what's on the 6 o'clock news. In fact, they don't even watch it most of the time. People are just, if anything, they'll read the Chronicle.
Right. Well, that's the reason I encourage you to
influence. I mean, if you're more bombarded, your senses are just really numbed. I mean, I couldn't, there were so many things I wanted to do, and I found that two things made it, you know, impossible for me to do. One, it's really the biggest awful thing in the Bay Area is just transportation, believe it or not. They have great mass transit, but it's really difficult to get to places. Especially if you live in the city, you're not gonna. It's, you know, you don't want to take a bus because it is, you know, it's a city, and there's a certain safety issues. You've got personal safety issues you've got to consider. So then, what do you do? I mean, the only viable option is it's freezing. I mean, you take the car. If you're two, you know, women going alone to a place, there's a real big safety issue. You don't want to park too far.
Well, that's a very valid question. What I encourage you to do is call up on January 22nd and ask them, because what you're talking about then is not even specifically Berkeley versus L.A., is you're talking about a city that has good mass transportation versus a city that doesn't.
No, I'm not saying that at all. So I'm saying a city that has so much the alternative media, in a place like San Francisco, the Bay Area, where there's so much alternative media, where people are really... You're talking, I mean, in the Chronicle, I don't think they do this in the LA Times, I know, because I read this in the LA Times. They have a section in the book review section of the Chronicle. It says that top 10 bestsellers in San Francisco, and it says top 10 bestsellers in the country, and there's very little overlap. I mean, it's very much it's a city unto itself. I mean, it's not mainstream America. That is for certain. even in the suburbs. And so in a city like San Francisco, how does the electronic, I mean, what is the influence? I think it's very minimal.
So your question is, why is San Francisco different than the rest of the cities in the U.S.?
I'm not saying that even.
Okay.
What's the story? I mean, if he's talking about the electronic community and how it has such an effect and an impact and it's an extension of the central nervous system, well, if it's that, in, you know, certainly it's going to be that in L.A., because this is the mecca for pop culture, okay? I mean, you know, you've got the record industries in L.A., the movie industries in L.A. That's just what L.A. I mean, it's not just, it's a very big part of it. That's not all of what L.A. is, but certainly to the rest of the world, that's what it's known for.
Well, I think you got a real valid question. I think if you refine it and call up and ask it, or if you just want to write it out and send it, you know,
yeah, I mean,
he'll respond to it on the 22nd.
Right. How does the electronic media play in places like San Francisco? Mainstream, you know, how does it play?
Sure.
Or does it play at all?
Oh, it does indeed.
I just, you know, what? But anyway, yeah, that's real interesting. So what, you're just volunteering your time to answer his phones? Or is
pretty,
this your own home number?
Yeah, this is my own home number. You can call me anytime if you want to talk about it. And, yeah, it's just volunteer. There's no money involved in this. Even though he has products like a book and a CD, he's not doing it because of money. He doesn't make any.
I think it's great.
Oh, yeah.
And he's doing it.
So I don't know if it was a comment on the industry and the popularity of Frank Zappa at that time. And I'd like to explain how the liner notes reveal that. The story in the back of the album.
Of John Wesley Hardy.
Yeah.
Okay. And were you working with him or what?
No, I was just in the studio, just hanging out.
Okay. Hold on, please.
Okay.
And the woman answers the door, a kind of middle-aged woman, she says, no, Dave's now.
Stangles.
Well, when will he be back?
You might have heard of the Church of Subgenius.
Of course.
Yeah, well, I was in the studio in late 67 when Bob was recording John Wesley Harding. I hung out with his team, and I can explain the liner notes, the story, which refers to Frank Zappa at the back, if you want to, for your listeners.
It refers to Frank Zappa?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
Well, you know the story very well in your mind?
Oh, of the back cover note.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, the key is Frank. Remember the three kings come? Now, the points made on the liner notes are that Frank is in the kitchen dishing himself out some meat. Now, he's dishing himself out, not dishing out the meat. And Frank, at that time in New York, was making the album Uncle Meat.
Yeah.
All right. And then at the end,
will go for this.
Okay.
So can you do it in a minute?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Okay.
No, we're not going to hang up on you.
Good.
But I don't know how to put you on hold. I'm going to try now.
Okay.
So we'll give you a minute and then I'm going to try and wrap it up. But thanks a lot.
Okay. Well.
Okay.
Okay.
Cheers. See you in a moment.
Yep.
What was the other
song? Well, you got it on your ass. There's some other way to get rid of them.
Now this is interesting. On the phone now we just have Bob Dobbs, and now we know him, or some people know him, as the head of the Church of the Subgenius.
Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How you doing?
Fine, John.
Well, you've got a story for us. I guess you were just listening on the radio.
Yes.
And you got a story, so fire away. The air is yours for a minute.
Thank you, John. Well, I was in the studio when Dylan was making John Wesley Harding in late 67, early 68, and in most of his liner notes on the albums of the 60s, he commented on the pop scene or the music scene. And Frank Zappa had been doing in New York a very prominent performance at the Garrick Theater. And I think Dylan wanted to comment on Frank, because Frank was kind of, Bob was hidden a bit then, and Frank was dominating the culture icon at that point. And so the story is about three kings visiting a man named Frank, and they're talking to him when they get there and quizzing him on the point, is the key you? And they keep saying the key is Frank, and Frank has to respond to this. So in the end, so when they meet Frank, he's describing, Dylan is the author describing Frank is in the kitchen dishing himself out the meat. Now, he's not dishing out the meat, he's dishing himself out. And the album Frank was working on in New York at that time, same time, was Uncle Meat. And then if you follow through the story, as the three kings encounter Frank, trying to find out if he is the key, Frank at the end responds by jerking himself all over the room, playing with a light bulb, and sort of doing a surrealistic theatrical performance piece. And that's Bob Dylan's interpretation of Frank's performance, his band, The Muslim Invention, at the Garrick Theater.
And how have you come to know this, or is it just a critical interpretation?
No, I was there with Dylan, and we talked about Frank and his performance at that time, and then I think our conversations gave him the idea of him making a comment on the pop culture scene, because the punchline of the story is the author, being Dylan,
right. Questions,
why do you have to goose yourself all over the room to make this point? And I think that was Dylan stating his Woodstock retirement phase, in the sense of withdrawing away from the culture art scene, the Warhol scene that had been going on in the 60s that he was part of in Manhattan. And he offered his simplicity metaphor in response to Frank as an anti-environment, as a mirror to Frank.
And where were you hanging out with Bob at this time? Where was Bob when you were having this conversation with him?
I think it was in Manhattan. I'm not sure, because I was involved with many people in the scene back then, and I just remember being in a studio, and I'm not in the music industry, so I don't know where the studio was, but it was in Manhattan, and we were just talking at the studio. I can't say exactly where it was.
Well, that is certainly a story.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Thank you a lot.
That's Bob Dobbs. Thanks for ringing up, Bob.
Okay, John.
Cheers.
Bye.
Well, and now, what else can we listen to?
But, John Wesley Harding, from the album John Wesley Harding.
You know what's amazing about that?
Hey, he was trying to bust you. I love it. What studio was it at? What street, Bob? Bob, man, I hang out with so many people, man. Look, I gotta give my address, Lugan.
You know what's amazing is I've always wanted to get that idea out to the Zappas, to the Dylan fans.
Oh.
And it got out there. It was meant to happen.
And this guy is a sub-genius, because right away he goes, yeah, I know Bobby. Zappas, he goes, this sounds good. Put it on. Because I already thought of this. As soon as I heard you doing this, I said, Bob, you should call up and just land
it. You thought of that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So did you tape that part separately?
Yeah, I taped it on a better tape, on good tape. Because this is on shitty tape.
So do you think that would sound real, that I couldn't remember what studio?
Oh, yeah.
You know, would that be realistic?
Well, we'll listen.
Yeah. Now, did you think Dylan did record in Manhattan? Wouldn't that be where he would fucking record?
It's so good because now, you know, Paul Williams is going, this guy looks, are you that in there? That fucking... And he goes, well, I'm not in the music business, so I got two CDs out.
Yeah, that's consistent because I had nothing to do with the CDs.
Right.
What?
I'm not in the music business, but I got two CDs.
No, no, I was consistent to him because I deny I have any connection to the CDs.
I know, no,
okay. Did you realize it that second?
Yeah. Gary, are you going to call now? Can
you
hear your story?
No. I'm out of here, man.
So, what do you think of that, Jerry? That went over all the Southland, didn't it? Hey, that fucking Dean is on there claiming he knew Bob Dylan. But what? Captain and Gals right now, Carol. You give us three? I'm glad I remembered the point. The point was Dylan was using a simplicity metaphor, you know?
Good. Because there were so many stories that were nothing. So now the cool thing is we got, there's three Dylan tapes, okay? Here's the first one. It's called Mare Scene 1. Mare Scene 2 has the pre-Bob Dobbs on Dylan talk. So you got, you explained to Ariana, and you explained it
to John. The three versions.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I got to tell you something because that's amazing. What happened is my mother raised me, a Roman Catholic, saying, your father never uses dirty words. And that's how I was raised. And then they always respected the fact that I worked for this great composer. Even though whatever he, you know, and appreciated what he stood for, independent thinking and whatever.
Yeah.
And they never really said, oh, it's sad. And that was such an ironic thing for them to finally meet him and see him rehearse and him to run through that. And they didn't really say anything to me like, that's so disgusting. They just took it as part of who he was.
That's what people do. But I've seen him do that. You know, before, and he brings it to a level, he would amplify it to a level that was more intense than normal.
I see. So you're saying it was like sickening.
Well, it was, yeah, it was like, it's this inner kind of energy that he had where he would do this thing, and everybody would be smiling the whole time, and yet you would know inside that there was all this kind of...
uncomfortable feeling?
Like a passive-aggressive kind of... burning up inside. You know, it's not really an aggressive move because it's not blatant. You couldn't point your finger at what it would be that would be aggressive. And yet, just by the fact that he's chosen to intensify it for the sake of, for, you know, of this audience, which he knows would be sensitive in this way, was a decision. I saw him do it a lot of times with various, you know, when it would happen, that usually parents coming in you know.
So are you saying his motivation was sort of like this was the only way he could get sort of this paradox out of his system, maybe?
Well, I don't know if it was a way of getting it out of his system, but I know that it was a choice to kind of turn up the heat and to kind of make everybody a little uncomfortable then.
Meaning the players and the observers?
Everybody.
Yeah.
You know, like your folks, in this example, if they were or not, that would be the intention. Because, I mean, it would be clear that everything would be going along, and, you know, you just, the obscenities or whatever would flow at the time that was right, either for, you know, the song or whatever, but not usually to make a loop out of it and have it be this thing that's like, it's only that, right?
Yeah.
And I saw it happen before, and so the thing that I came away always thinking with Frank about that was that it was kind of, it was strange, you know, not entirely...
It was like an immature extremity.
Yeah, and showing that he's that like there's kind of something a little bit wrong inside with him is maybe like could be emotionally frozen at a certain age or just that this was kind of an aggressive move in a passive way against people that are his allies, and for the sake of kind of setting up this wall between him and the rest of the world and rubbing people's face in it, even in the context of kind of a friendly gathering, you know, which that would be.
Yeah.
It's a subtle thing, but it's just, the thing that's making me say this, think about all this, is that thinking about him going out at age 52 is that he, in my impression, he burned up his energy, you know, fast, because this kind of stuff going on, that's like a lot of inner conflict and resistance and stuff, and it's, you know, he carried a lot of this kind of deep resentment, you know, and,
right,
and disillusionment and real, you know, like rage, kind of anger, you know, and I think that kind of serves to burn you up fast.
I think that's an accurate observation, because a friend of mine is who actually did the best Zappa interview ever. Someday I'll give you a copy of it. It's a 72-page booklet. And he basically said, not in the interview, but he said that Frank is like an angry high school kid who got pushed around by the bullies, so he's like trying to get back. He has sort of like this attitude that he was trying to get back.
Yeah, like there's, yeah, he was done wrong, and this will show everybody. Kind
yeah.
of. But, you know, and that's just part of it, because what an amazingly powerful soul. God.
Yeah, I mean, it all contributes to his output. It's the big picture view.
Yeah.
It's just that what amazing that to inspire independent thinking and be the composer that he is
right.
at the same time. And it's sort of like, did you read Daniel Shore's tribute in the Times a couple of days ago?
No, I didn't.
Well, it was sickening to me in a way, because the guy says, you know, Frank did this for the kids, and this for the kids, for his kids and the kids of the world. And when you look at it, there's really not much music in the rock pop world that you can call adult and as adolescent at the same time.
Right.
Frank was both. He's like the most adult rock music ever, but he's also the most Beavis and Butthead-ish. Who was his favorites was Beavis and Butthead.
Right.
And it's just like, God, Frank, get a life, man.
Well, boy, he invented life, man. That's the thing that's amazing. How life seemed like about five times as big in his presence, you know.
That's it. That's a great line. He invented life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he, you know, around him, it was like a different life. It seemed like being in, everything was intensified and just.
It was like we were at Thomas Nordic's once shooting this video, and they had like K-Rock on. I goes, that music will turn you into a normal person, and Frank goes, not me.
That's right. Wow. Well, you know, it's funny. I really wish I had seen him at the end, and yet it was too difficult for me to to kind of put it together in terms of everything that had gone and how it all was. And, you know, I didn't want to go up there and do a typical night of listening to, like, 8 hours of his music.
I know. That's one thing you told me in the past.
Well, I love his music, you know.
Right, but
just like, I that wasn't it, you know. I couldn't.
Yeah.
I don't know what. And so I didn't want to go either, and kind of with the understanding of, well, you know, this is it, and I guess we'll see each other again.
Yeah.
You know, and it seemed hard to be any other way than realistic with Frank. And anyway, but I don't know. I kind of have a strange peace around it, too, because I feel like that, man, I'm glad that he's out of turmoil, you know. It was,
I know. That's exactly what Tommy said. And I said to Tommy, yo, Pop's checked out. And he goes, yeah, I'm happy for him.
Right.
And most people can't say that. I mean, I've been talking to people for 3 days. And
Matt, you probably talk with everybody.
And it's amazing when someone like you says that, because you got to realize that. And you also got to realize the New Orleans philosophy that you celebrate when someone dies.
Exactly.
You know, somebody said to me 3 weeks ago, you should cry when someone's born and rejoice when they die.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean any less love for Frank, man.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter how we're going to deal with it, because it's never forgotten, you know.
Yeah.
For sure. I'm going to write, you know, I'm getting together to write to Gail and the kids a card. And,
yeah.
Know, I have this real desire to communicate. I feel like it's, I don't know, like it's not more than it's important, but just that it's meaningful.
Yeah.
In a way, you know.
Well, that's
good. I had to be talking with you now, you know, somehow this energy just is, it's like getting the energy correct. Everybody talking to each other, it's kind of like lay Frank's soul in a good place, you know, so it's all, it's really just featuring the good stuff and kind of understanding what was difficult, but that's not really what you remember, you know. You
that's
remember
it.
Everything, but.
Yeah, all pain and all suffering is a test.
Yeah.
And we've been indoctrinating to believe that though that is bad, but it's not. And that's how Frank said that in a way. He said, I'm a failure, but I'm not a miserable failure.
Why was he a failure?
Because, you know, that's what he would say. He just said, I'm a failure, you know, I don't know.
He was in these amazing contradictions, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, his version of losing money could also be, when you're looking at the other side, make a lot of money. You know?
Oh, exactly.
And, yeah. I don't know. You know, that was the same. He was kind of like, I don't know, well, anyway, God bless him, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Greatest.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you calling me about this radio thing, but I'm going to call the guy.
Oh, good, Ed. I hope you do, and I appreciate you participating in that and talking with me. That was really healthy.
Great, man. Jerry, what's your address?
24-27.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hello?
Hello. Is this Jerry?
Hi, Bruce.
Hey, how are you?
All right, man.
You're surviving?
I'm surviving, man. I've talked to people for 3 days.
I'm sure.
And it's been pretty intense because I got laid off 2 weeks before it happened.
You're kidding.
No. But I read some of your comments in the Daily News.
Yeah.
And I thought those were pretty good. Were you satisfied with what he printed?
Did well on that one.
It was good. Being in the same article with Neil Diamond.
Yeah, that is the highlight of my entire career.
That's great. Did you know that before that you read that the mothers back Neil Diamond? Yeah, it's for real, man. And there, in fact, there's a Neil Diamond video where there's old photographs and you can see the mother's drum set up in the back. And I actually asked Frank once why he did that, and he goes, I don't know, we got paid to back him up. It's just one of those surreal things.
Oh, man, that's too bad. I did a bunch of radio things. Did you know that, man?
What show or what station?
I think it was on KFI and The Wave. That's the only ones I know about.
Really? Did you get tapes of them or anything?
No. I got called that night, Sunday night, man.
Oh.
Associated Press called me.
Wow.
They got my number from Rip Rent.
Oh.
And they, you know, nobody, I knew nobody wanted it. Nobody was going to talk over there at the family. And,
yeah.
So.
Well, you're a good spokesman.
I tried to say nice things and I tried to think of concise things, but it was tough, man, because it was Sunday night, and it was like, I just found out about it.
How did you find out?
Well, Don called me.
Don called you?
Yeah.
How did he find out?
He found out from Rip.
Oh.
And I guess Rip had been called by Gail, but he wasn't there, and Gail was trying to ask him to help with some of the press.
Oh, I see.
And so, I don't know how AP got a hold of it, but this lady called me like 1 in the morning, and I talked to her for about 20 minutes, and she said, you know, she put some, I didn't come up with a really great quote or anything. But,
yeah.
But at least, you know, I think they were okay.
No, they were fine. I think that you were articulate, and so how did Don react?
He was really, really, really depressed.
Was he?
Yeah. You know, I guess they, from what Rip said, I guess they did make peace and everything. They were okay.
Oh yeah, I think.
Sure of that. In fact, he told me that Don really helped. See, I felt a lot of guilt for not going to see Frank. You know.
Well, you can't feel guilt.
Well, I
you can, but I mean.
I'm trying to not, you know.
Yeah.
Missed a chance, but anyway. Now, what can you do?
Yeah.
But At any rate, he was just said, God, I can't believe it, man. You know,
yeah.
That's what I mean. That's when that quote that's in the Daily News, that was from talking to him. And we just didn't say hardly anything. It was a weirdest conversation because we were both speechless.
It is. It's hard to say anything. I mean, it's incredibly mind blowing at 52.
Yeah.
You know, because he definitely had tons more to offer, but in retrospect, you have to realize that he's definitely left an amazing catalog.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of inspiration for people to think independently. The best thing I've heard from all these people who've called me is this guy, Dave Turner, said, you know what Frank taught me? He said, don't believe what I say, go find out for yourself.
Right.
That's brilliant.
That's a good quote, man. I think we should use that.
Yeah,
Musician Magazine is calling me, you know.
Yeah, tell him. That's what one of the fans told you, said that, you know, he learned from Frank. Don't believe me, go learn for yourself. Go find out yourself. That's like...
It's not the only thing, but there's, you know, I mean...
Right. But it was a major point was Frank was an independent thinker. That's what got him in trouble, is that he wasn't afraid to express his thoughts, whereas most people cushion. They might think things radically, but they're afraid to express them because they want to conform and keep things safe.
Yeah, and they can keep their record deal, and they can, you know...
Right, and it's safety. Just everything about daily life as well, that people seek out safety because it's easier. And to take a chance and a risk and express yourself, that's risky, and it might get you in trouble.
Well, and it did get Frank in trouble.
It did.
You know, but and yet this is just a kind of a stroke of fate or something. I don't know what the hell it is.
Yeah.
Just a disease, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess I heard they almost got it, man.
Really?
That's what Rip said. He told me that he did that cyclotron treatment.
What's that?
That's a treatment, an experimental treatment. And that it almost killed him. He said he did it like 12 times.
And it's called what again?
Cyclotron. You know what a cyclotron is?
A cyclotron, no, I don't.
Well, it's like a little particle accelerator.
Uh-huh.
Only it operates in a circle. I mean, it's like a circular particle accelerator with magnets that increases the speed of particles.
Uh-huh.
And they, you know, so they evidently shot it with particles. And I don't know. See, this is something I don't know if you should tell people because I'm really weak on the facts.
Oh, no, I'm not telling anybody.
But I guess Rip went and saw him a lot.
Rip was, I guess, close to him there at the end, writing all those liner notes for Yellow Shark. I mean, that's a huge booklet.
Yeah. And anyway, he said that Don called him during that time a lot.
Don called Frank or Don called Rip?
For Frank.
Really?
And really helped Frank.
Oh, that's good.
According to Rip, Don really helped him because he said Frank was almost giddy. I heard from Fleet, man. That was great hearing from Fleet.
Really?
No, real neat, you know. And I remember he was talking to Frank, and he called me and told me, you know. So evidently over a period of some of those same months when he was undergoing serious treatment,
yeah,
Don called him a bunch of times. You know how Don goes. He goes and gets like on a thing and calls people.
Yeah, I know. I was fortunate enough to be one for 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't seem to do that now.
52 times, which is a key number.
Yeah.
That's how old Frank was when he died.
Yeah.
And it was my favorite number. It was very unique that it happened that way. You know, in that Don called me 52 times in 1991.
Yeah, so I've been meaning to call you, you know. I've been just...
Oh, it's no problem. I just called you, Bruce, mainly because there's this station in the Bay Area that's interested because they're doing 24 hours. And things you've heard before.
Oh, I just said the way she did it. Her name is see. I mean, you know, she'll interview someone that you know, she'll try to say the pertinent fact about someone and interview someone that knew them, you know.
Right, and then ask you how that you react to that?
Yeah, or just say something about the person.
So you feel...
This guy who used to be in the band had this comment.
And you feel confident because she's done her research.
Yeah, and she was really appreciative that I called her back, because they were really, at first they were really taken by surprise because the funeral was already over and it was
right.
Bizarre, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was really kind of, she didn't, you know, and they didn't, you know, they knew about the things like the, you know, those kind of people, they know about things like the Harris Senate hearing and
right.
Different things. What they want is some of the other stuff. So I tried to point out some of the things like you're talking about, things about, you know, playing things like Stravinsky and
right.
Things and then sneaking those things in.
Right.
When the guy yells "Freak me out," Frankie plays Bartok, you know? Stuff like that, you know. But you know, still, I wasn't. They said, "Well, what have you got planned for the memorial?" So this is like an hour after I found out.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I said the thing I'll do is work harder and try to write some great music, because you know that's exactly what.
That's good, Bruce. I like that. That's great.
Well, it's the truth, you know.
Yeah.
What else can you do? That's what he did all the time.
Yeah.
Know? So I pointed out that was why I thought the Daily News, but then I had figured out that thing about not wasting a minute and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, one of the key things. Plus, I told her, I said, you know, here's a guy who was able to make an actual business doing what he loved to do.
What he loved to do, exactly.
Was not, you know, playing up to the being directed, but being, you know, blatantly honest about stuff.
Yeah. That's very hard.
So she got a lot of good stuff, man. I mean, she really did. I'm sure she played it because I had people call me.
Yeah.
They heard it. And it probably went all over the country.
Great.
She had 750 stations, she said.
Oh, great.
So I don't know. It was kind of odd. I felt like a weird spokesman because I haven't even seen him since that tour.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, listen, man, I worked for him for 9.5 years, and I hardly saw Frank. You know, I saw him once a year at the end. So, I mean, I think, you know, listen.
Oh, well, and I know that, see, the fact that we kind of got into that thing and we were kind of fighting over money a little bit, and they resent things like that, although I really don't think they should.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, you were always a favorite of Frank's, man. He knew, less like I did, you're like one of the greatest soloists because it's so inspirational hearing you play. I mean, even at the pier that day, we just saw you. That was amazing. And,
I always had a good relationship with him, except for this last thing. And I blame that man more than anything on his disease, because I think that even outside of the whole weird thing that happened,
yeah,
I think maybe part of that was even caused by his disease somehow, and I don't know how.
Yeah,
but he just was. I'll never forget the last time I saw him when he was in Italy, sitting in this chair in the middle of this dark room with one chair in the entire room.
Uh huh.
And had one light bulb in the ceiling with no cover, just sitting there by himself.
Yeah.
And haven't had this look like, I mean, I couldn't fucking believe it, man. It was nothing I could take. Except I said, well, I hope, you know, I said, despite all this stuff, I've enjoyed working on this thing. And da-da-da, I'm sure he thought it was bullshit. But I had to say something to him, and
yeah.
Walt walked in for a while, and I walked in. We kind of took turns, and a bunch of the guys, and
yeah,
you know, and we had got to the point on that tour where we were going completely insane.
Right.
I mean, and he was too. Everybody was.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a shame that happened. I know he harbored resentment because Paul Carman called me last night.
Uh huh.
He went and saw him a couple of years ago, and he was still super pissed about that.
Really?
And then he gave that interview to Musician Magazine.
Right.
I never read, actually, but, you know, I guess he was putting this down pretty bad. You know, fate put us down and stuff. But see, you got to think of it like Buddy Rich, man.
Exactly. And, you know, the sad thing about that was none of the press ever gave you guys the chance to tell your side of the story.
That's what I think Resistance Magazine might be doing, man. They wanted to talk to us about some about the Zappa article. So I wonder if he's going to try to get some controversy going or what, you know. I don't want that, you know.
No, it's not necessary, but it's something that people have known. I mean, I've always stressed it in talking with people that, you know, there's many views to stories. And, you know, one friend of mine even said that was bad management skills on Frank's part, point, you know. But, you know.
Well, but, you know, it's everybody's fault.
Yeah, right. But, you know, when you're the boss and there's a conflict, it's your job to help resolve it.
Actually, he made it worse, if anything.
Yeah, that's what I mean, but...
But I don't think he meant to. It just,
no.
But you know how he is. Things come right out.
He's sort of like the camaraderie and the dedication he had to Scott. He felt obliged to stand up for him, you know? So it wasn't...
It wouldn't have been like that except that he had to be the clone meister.
Yeah.
I mean, if he would have just been in the band...
Right.
We could have maybe dealt with it, but since he had the power and he was abusive of it.
Oh,
he
yeah.
was abusive of it.
Oh, yeah.
Not Frank. He did it when Frank wasn't around.
Right.
And Frank never really knew it.
Yep.
So he was, from Frank's perspective, he's going, why are these guys so weird, you know?
Yep.
But he didn't see what we did for months.
Yeah, but you know that,
It was that band, that interim band that had Malcolm McNabb and those guys.
Right, like a mini Grand Wazoo band?
Yeah, that band.
Yeah?
With the Earl Dumbler and...
The long pauses between his statements. And so often, Marshall was going, well, I don't know. You know, these guys would hire him huge bucks for consulting them, you know, General Motors.
Marshall?
Yeah, and they would he would just say these things and they would sit there in awe like, wow. And then he would go in the middle of the day, he'd go to church. He was a devout Catholic.
Yeah.
And they would follow him to Mass.
Bob Dobbs is obviously from Canada also, as was McLuhan.
He is.
Yeah. Because I noticed his accent was definitely Canadian.
Yeah.
And of course, McLuhan was also a colleague of another one of my favorites.
Finnegan's Wake, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot.
Ezra Pound is a poet.
Ezra Pound's a poet, exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. If you study McLuhan and then you study where McLuhan got his ideas, a lot of the there was mention of various other people who have discussed this. I would say one is William Irwin Thompson, and the book Bob was mentioning today was The Time Falling Bodies Take to Light. And he has like 10 books you can find. Terence McKenna, Mabe Russell. There's many people that you can study and understand where Bob is coming from. Frank Zappa. There's, you know, it's.
Right.
And then you take each one of these people that Bob has learned from, and then you study where they came from. So.
Yeah, I told you to pick up Marshall McLuhan.
Pick up Marshall McLuhan. The Medium is a Massage. You can get it at used bookstores for $1, and it is in print, so you can get it.
Yeah.
And send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, or a self-addressed envelope with 3 stamps, and I'll send you 4.5 pages of information, and including Bob's liner notes from his CD.
Okay.
so you don't even have to buy the CD, and you can just read the liner notes.
Right. And how were you introduced to Bob?
Say it again?
How were you introduced to Bob?
I met Bob in 88, and how, it was just, well, how did I meet Bob? He was interested in Frank Zappa, and I was working for Frank Zappa at the time. So we've been in communication with each other and spent lots of time. I've got over 22 hours of dialogue with him, which I intend to put out in a book. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you can, if you include $5, you can get a 17-page dialogue that I did with him called Entertainment Sucks, and that might help you understand a little of the whole situation of L.A. being an industry town.
Right.
And pretty much void of any content. I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, you have a lot of potential with movies, but there's no content.
Right. Okay, well, thanks a lot. And I'll go ahead and send that out.
Cynthia, great talking to you. Thanks for talking.
Right. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye. Hello?
Jerry.
Yes. Hi, Mark. Did you listen?
Yeah, I got shut out, though.
What do you mean you got shut out?
Well, I got up to like 6 to listen to Marshall. Then I dozed out and went to feed the dogs. I came back from like 7:30 until 8:30. I tried dialing in, and I...
Oh, you couldn't get in.
Couldn't get in.
Well, you can get in next time. It'll be January 22nd.
Yeah, I just was kind of bummed.
Well, what did you think of the show?
What I thought was pretty good.
Yeah? Anything specific?
No, I was, was real tired, and I was just trying to listen, just trying to be ready to...
Uh-huh. That's the problem. That's exactly why Bob never participated when he went to McLuhan's Dialogues in Canada.
Right.
Because then you miss everything that's going on because you're too concentrating on what you're going to say.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I didn't miss everything, but I,
Well, no, I don't mean to say everything.
See, I knew that you were going to possibly get a tape of it and listen to it later. See, that's what I'm saying.
There you go. You got that down then.
So like I said, I knew there would be at least the, So I was trying to focus on what I was going to say, and then I fucking sit there on hold, and I sat there and was dizzy. I was like, shit.
Well, doesn't it ring?
No, it's just like, I got busy for the first, 15 or 20 times since I got tried to call you in the last half hour, and it's been busy.
But once you got through and you're put on hold...
It just keeps ringing. Yeah.
Oh, it just keeps ringing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I heard even after it rings 20 times, it shuts off and never shut off.
It never shut off on me.
Okay.
I didn't actually get through until where I was calling one of the lights on the switch to it until it's about 8:15. And then I was just waiting there for like 15 minutes and just never picked up. Case are all right, they're running. The way it is.
Say that again?
I said I was on hold the last 15 minutes.
No, you said que sera?
Sera Rice-A-Roni,
Que sera Rice-A-Roni?
Yeah, que sera Rice-A-Roni. What will be Rice-A-Roni?
Is that a San Francisco kind of thing?
Yeah.
not the Bay Area again.
Yeah, that's not the Bay Area again. Yeah.
Well, you know why I said that.
To the Bay Area. He lived with Gary Snyder in Berkeley.
Right, because the important question that came out of the audience was, here you're a founder of the Beat Generation with Kerouac and with William Burroughs, but you are all nature nice, and Burroughs is all junky bad. So what was the connecting idea that got you guys to find the Beat Generation? And he said, well, we weren't anti-communist, and we weren't anti-American. So that was a good question, and Gary is very, very articulate.
Yeah, he's unbelievable. His poetry is really great.
Yep.
Wow. So how was your morning other than that? Good? That you gave to me, and he was saying, oh, a lot of this is disinformation. That's what he said to me. A lot of this is disinformation.
You damn straight is disinformation.
I said, don't you understand that it's satirical in nature?
That's not even it. Bob is... Everything Bob says is totally true and totally bullshit.
Right, that's what I'm saying. The satire of the whole thing.
He's a manipulative satirist, yep.
Yeah.
But you can't just take that in the general sense.
Now, I've never tried to find a good definition of manipulant.
I know. Well, that's another. You got to get Bob to do it on the show, because rather than me trying to explain it, do it on the show and let him explain it. Because, see, it's tongue-in-cheek. Just like everybody thought me, when McLuhan said the medium is the messiah, is the message, that he was meaning it. He said it as a joke on the side.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, it's just like the McLuhan rap. He said it this morning. He says the medium is the message. It's like, what's the message in a light bulb? You know, that was the bottom line. The first thing he said on the McLuhan interview was the best, because it is. It is. You know, it's true in a lot of ways, and it's not true. It's just like you need to be able to look at the big picture.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, I know that certainly Bob's lexicon is alienating to a lot of people. You know, they can't. A lot of people, once they feel like they've heard four or five words that they don't understand, instead of being stimulated by it, they feel threatened.
It makes them want to grab their crotch.
Yeah. Or it makes them want to just, you know, say that this is either that's highfalutin, or he's just spewing for the sake of, you know, and there's a word my mother used to use. She used to say he's being multisyllabic,
David.
Hi. It's interesting. I turned off the KPFK, and in a moment I turned on Channel 28. They had Doctor Who on, and it was very interesting that the synergistic relationship of a lot of the concepts and words and et cetera was happening on Doctor Who this morning.
It's resonating.
I know this too.
You know, I think we've got to plan something where we can get you and Bob on, because I know David doesn't really want to cut you off.
I know.
But at the same time, he's time pressure, because if you heard those calls at the beginning, boy, they just flowed so well, because there was no time pressure.
Yeah, I tried to call in earlier, but it's...
I know, it's hard.
Possible.
But one of these times,
I wonder if David's calling, so I started trying again.
Yeah, that was good. I like that. But I'll tell you, David, one of these times, maybe after, because Furry Lynn, I think we're going to play some of this little rap that you have on Furry Lynn about going into the, you know, that rap is about 10 minutes on Furry Lynn of you. And so one of these
times. I'm driving down the freeway one day.
Yes. Yeah.
This way out.
This way out. This way out rap.
Yeah.
So I think one of these times, if not this one in January, the one after that, we should just set aside, you know, a 30-minute chunk so you two guys can talk a little. And it's really just you, because you're so eloquent. You're one of the few people who can get Bob to shut up.
Well, because he was amazingly probing when he first came to visit. In other words, when I first met him, he came in with all these questions, and I listened to him for a while, and finally I says, you know, I don't know whether I'll bother with you. And he says, why? He says, aren't these brilliant questions, and et cetera. I says, yeah, but if you ask them, and it's as though you enjoy the process of asking the question, and you don't even pay any attention to what I say afterwards, that you're too busy formulating the next question.
Boy, that's just what we were talking about, because my other friend sat there and tried to call, because he had a big question today. And I said to him, that's exactly how Bob wouldn't do his dialogues with McLuhan, because he sat at all these McLuhan lectures and he would never participate, because he figured he'd miss things, because he'd be concentrating on how he was going to get his question in, where he was going to fit it in, what he was going to say, and then he would miss what's happening.
So Bob himself said that.
Bob himself said that about when he talked with McLuhan, when he attended the McLuhan lectures, he would never participate because he knew he'd miss stuff.
Well, you know, in my own case, I remember Gehenna Brati, who was this, he was a...
The prophet?
No.
Oh, what's his name?
He was a guy who was born into one of the wealthiest families in Austria.
Oh, say his name once again, I'm sorry.
Agnihananda Bharati.
Okay.
Which was a taken name, which means homeless bliss. Anyway, he... What was I going to say about him? I forgot. Isn't that wonderful?
I love it.
I got into the bliss and didn't want to leave.
Woo! Yeehaw, as Carolyn would say.
He took a group of us at the Center of Integration and taught the first course in history involving semantics and as applied to philosophy and religion. That it was that the very word semantics or general semantics, the concept of it, was not applicable to such things. You never applied that to philosophy and religion. And so he taught this course, and he would talk at a rate of speed that was absolutely incredible. And there was 2 hours in each class, and it went on for, I think, 8 weeks. So there was like 16 hours of these classes in which he went through all of the different basic philosophies and religions of the world and how to look at them semantically and using the concept of the neurolinguistic reaction.
Right.
Anyway, it was so incredible that I lived in the center, so I had access, but I would listen to that 2 hours maybe twice a day.
Uh-huh.
Every day for a week in order to get everything that he'd said and be ready for the next level. And he was stunned that I even bothered him. And I even tried to tape it up, to type it up from tape.
Yeah.
And he thought that was very great, except when he looked at it, he said, no, it's horrible, horrible. He says, the syntax, he says, it may come out that way. But he says, I can't accept this transcription as like me writing. I said, but it's verbatim. He says, I know. He says, but I don't write that way. I may talk that way, but I don't write that way. And so I understood. And anyway, the whole reference I'm making to is that when you're listening to someone, you have to listen. Like I with Agnihananda Bharati.
Right.
I would listen totally every time for this 2 hours without really thinking because I knew I could listen to the tapes.
Let me tell you, just interject briefly, that's exactly what Mark just told me. He says, I knew I could concentrate on my question because I know, Jerry, you were taping it and that I could just listen to the tapes. So go ahead.
Yeah, it's like various times while I was trying to connect the phone through, I was so interested in what was coming over, I just hang up and not try to call so I could hear it.
Right.
That happened about 4 or 5 times while I was phoning, is I would be hearing something going on that I wanted to hear rather than try to get in and talk. And at a certain point I thought, well, maybe I won't call in today because it's so interesting, I'm just going to listen. And then Bob says, I wonder if David Woods is going to call.
Right.
So I tried again.
It was a great show. I'm glad you did.
You had the feedback call-in?
The feedback call-in's been good so far.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How many people have called in relation to this
number? You're the fourth one, and it's each one's been 20, 30 minutes. So,
huh?
It's...
Who do you think called and what kind of...
Two women and you, and then Mark and then you.
Uh-huh. And what did the women, were there women's black, or the blacks?
No, they weren't. From me trying to guess, I would say neither of them were black. And
I know there was some on there, and I just wondered if
the black women were marvelous today. That one woman brought up the best point about the blacks versus the blacks here, and then the blacks versus the black in Africa.
And then the levels of the leaders and so on.
Exactly, and the levels of the leaders, polarization. And I'm telling you, this show was so great because it brought it down to the KPFK level of community radio.
Yeah.
And it brought it right to the streets and says, why is this 23-year-old drug dealer making it big on TV?
But also, I love the guy calling in and talking about being a street person, and then Bob coming back and says, well, you know, that's what Marshall McLuhan was, really.
I know it. That was brilliant.
That what he was a street person trying to put on everybody else, and he was identified with that more than what people think of him. And I agree.
And I agree, and I was hoping...
And I consider myself the same thing, except I don't know whether you call it a street person, but what I am is a... Well, in the case of my family, they were all Republicans, you see.
Oh, your personal family, your mother...
My personal family was not only Republicans, but they were the heaviest Republicans, because, I don't know, you may have heard this or not, but in 1870, my great-grandfather was so wealthy that he set up an $8 million trust fund to establish the Worcester Bible College and the Hepzibah Missionary Society and a town called Zion in Iowa. As it is, a few people went out and bought plots and some built houses in Zion, but they were moving so fast they had to move into Tabor, which was about 6 miles away, and establish the college, and then that's where they wound up living. And that's where Tabor, Iowa, is where Worcester Bible College was.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, that was a kind of a holiness renegade group that were kind of going back and yet expanding out. And they had plenty of money to work with. And so the students of that college set up the 19 major denominations of the Bible Belt. And then, of course, they fed back more students into it. And then there was another byproduct that came that started in Wheaton, Illinois. Wheaton the College, I think it was. Anyway,
uh-huh.
That's a spinoff. And, of course, on my father's mother's side of the family, my great-grandmother there was the sister of Governor Marl, Ann Marl Lindbergh's father. And then on on my mother's side, Grandma Harrison was related to Vice President Curtis, who was a Republican. When my father was about 20, in his mid-20s, he inherited a lot of money. At that time, he was the dean of the college. And when he inherited all this money, he decided to take a sabbatical. And the man who replaced him was Ed Eisenhower.
Uh-huh.
The uncle of Ike. And so in his many travels, he went around and he gave away 40 cars in a space of about 15 years.
Wow.
To ministers and missionaries and sometimes politicians. And he gave lots of money. And on his trips, he went down into Abilene, Kansas, and stayed with the Eisenhower family down there and gave them a new car. I understand it was a big Cadillac, 5,000, you know, which is a big deal then.
Uh-huh.
And $5,000 that was the money that financed Ike's going to West Point.
Uh-huh.
And the people who encouraged... And then what happened is they wanted... The Eisenhowers wanted to do a favor back, and so they wanted him to meet John Hastings' daughter in Topeka. And John Hastings' daughter is Golden, my mother. So the Eisenhower family, Ike's parents, is the one who arranged the meeting of my parents. And then about 7 years old, I do know that we had a friend of the family, another family, big wealthy family, named the Andersons, John Anderson, and they were from Sweden, I think, originally. Although, I guess, his brother must have been born in America, because you have to be an American citizen to run, I mean, a born American citizen to run for president. But the funny thing is, here's these Republican, John Anderson was the biggest Republican in the state who actually fronted and financed Alf Landon. And his brother was a socialist who ran on the Socialist Party. In 1936, here John Anderson sponsored Alf Landon. His brother, a former president, his brother ran on the Socialist Party, and both of them came to our house for dinner and argued during this presidential campaign when I was 7 years old.
Uh-huh.
And also that the whole process of politics involved with the Worcester Bible College, because of the medical missionaries and the medicine and all the rest of it, and in having been involved in high finance to begin with, and knowing the Rockefellers and so on, because I used to hear all kinds of stories about what Rockefeller said, how he wouldn't give his kids any money, they had to earn it. Just because he was wealthy, he wasn't going to let them have
a free ride.
No, they didn't even get an allowance.
Oh, wow.
When I was a kid, I wanted an allowance. I told my dad I wanted an allowance because I'd heard of my other friends getting them. And then he gave me the John D. Rockefeller story. And he said, you have to earn it. But then he turned out to be real generous. I didn't even need an allowance. But at any rate, the Worcesters were the ones who were very key in wiping out the whole medical field in 1913. All those medical laws and the medical schools were shut down. You know about that.
Wow.
That most of the medical the medicine that was on the shelves that you could just go and get that had cocaine and had the opium and all the rest of it, they wiped that out, and they wiped out about 75% of all the medical colleges, and only about 25% were left under those laws. And at the same time, in the same time frame, and I'm not sure just how close in time they were, but in the same time frame, they created the Federal Reserve System. And there's been two Worcesters, that have been members of that 1,500. See, it's limited to 1,500 people, and these people have to own banks or banking systems to even be a member. And there's 15,000 banks, so there's only 10% of the banks in the country can be members, and in order to be a member, you have to own all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, as I grew up, and it's like I didn't know a lot of this till I was about 12, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because my father wouldn't talk about it. He would have a chip on his shoulder about certain things that happened within the family. So his aunt, who raised him, came to visit, and one time when I came home from school, they were having an argument in the living room, and I came into the hall where you couldn't see me, you know, and I heard them, and so I went upstairs and stood upstairs and listened to them have this argument, and that's how I found, I didn't know how much wealth my father had had, because we were living fairly poor.
And that's how you found out.
Well, I found out that her sons had bamboozled him out of most of it.
Uh-huh.
He'd been generous and spent a lot of it, but then there was a huge, $625,000 from one deal that one of the brothers got him into, and when somebody died, they said, well, it was oversold, so you don't get anything. And then of course, it turns out when he died, he left a huge fortune and didn't leave one cent to my mom.
Wow.
And so anyway, is that whole relationship with all of the Republicans, in which I heard them come right out and say what they felt. And in a sense, they were an elitist group who felt that people as a whole could not govern, that they had to have
Uh-huh.
And I rebelled against this when I was in my teens. And so my father wanted me to go on into, you know, he had certain plans, not this tight. In other words, he didn't want me to repeat his way exactly, because he was fed up with some of it, but he had a new way for me to go, so to speak, that I would still go to college, I would do this, and probably wanted me to be a minister or a missionary, something like that. So when I found a way to sort of escape from that and go off in my own direction, that was quite an accomplishment, you know, in terms of an individual child exerting enough power to do that without being, and yet I lived a very fair life. I wasn't highly reactive, you know, I was so well formed I wasn't highly reactive, but then as I went on out, and I did later did all these things, I wound up setting up something very similar to what my great-grandfather did.
Oh my
God. See? Servants of Awareness, with all these people who went out and helped establish all kinds of organizations and things, and had a profound effect on the whole country and the government. The awareness movement came out of it, you see. And except this time, my way of looking at it was to do it where it wasn't pre-planned by somebody else, that everybody got together and discovered what to do, and the emanation of that action went out more than words. Words went out, but the emanation was more important than the words, and by the time people read it, for instance, we used to have unique phrases that would come up in the readings, at, you know, in the awareness work back in the 60s and somewhat in the 70s, but the words, this syntax or this use of these words would come out in our readings, which had hardly ever appeared anywhere, especially not that grouping together. And within, if it was really something hot that had to do with the environment or with war or with, you know, with all the things that were going on back in the 60s, everything that was really hot would be on national television coming out with those phrases within 3 or 4 weeks. It's just almost like it went through the group that we knew. They used the words, and it just escalated right out into the media.
Amazing. I think it's like what Bob thinks, the only way the media fast is actually going to happen is it's going to be that natural flowing. It's not going to be like a no-smoking day for a day, you know. It's not going to be a few people doing this little thing, it's going to be everybody participating because it came naturally to them.
Well, what they're doing is they get on overload. Now, for instance, after the fires here, people were shutting off the television for quite a while. They got too much. They watched it because it was so fascinating.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, they were on overload.
Right.
And at least that's what I've found out.
Yeah.
And for myself, I probably paid more attention because it was live television, whereas a lot of other people couldn't handle it. They watched it as much as they could, but they started turning it off. And so I think overload is what turns it off. Now we've got the same situation that happened in Vietnam. Overload turned that off.
Right.
And in the case of Bosnia, overload is turning it off. Now, it's going to take longer for it to turn off over there because it's a 400-year-old antagonism. But the strange thing is everybody is not... They know that to try to get that solved is going to swallow everything that goes into it up. So it's almost like, well, just let them run it out. If they can't see it, if they can't get enough on overload themselves to turn it off, then just let them go until sometime they have exhausted all their resources, as long as you can keep the sanctions so they can't get any more resources in. And that means not going in there just let them go at it until it's all done. It, of course, it's genocide. It's triple genocide. But it's like those people have been the source of the major conflicts of the world. weren't even very good Catholics, except that there's like the, supposedly the Eastern Catholic wing got up in there somehow, the Greek Orthodox and so on. And then the Croats, of course, are essentially Catholic, Roman Catholic stocks, pretty much. So you've got these three major religious political identities that have been in each other's throats for hundreds of years. And if you try to get a definition on it, you don't get a definition in present time. And even if you go back 400 years, you didn't have a definition then. Alright, I think if the Muslim of the world related in there, and if the Catholics of the world related in there, and the others related in there, then you would have had another World War III. Because that's where, you know, Sarajevo was where the Austrian prince was shot that caused the start of World War I.
Right.
And that when the Nazis went down into Croatia and tried to go in further, they got thwarted by the the communists, or actually it was still really essentially a religious ethnic confrontation that stalled them off. And I forgot why I was starting to talk about all this, but except that all that energy over in Bosnia, in the Bosnia area, is such a frustration that nobody can come up with an answer, and yet there are the crybabies of the world that are screaming, but that they're creating genocide, we've got to stop it. And what we have to do is just listen to these crazies say they're creating genocide, we have to stop it. If you just notice the people who are trying to do something about it aren't paying any attention to that.
Right.
And the ones who are crying about the genocide are really a bunch of do-nothing flakes that have never done anything in their life but scream for somebody to do something about something, you know?
Right.
And so on. And I think I've been feeling this, it's a dreadful energy to look at. If you look at it normally, you can do something about it, and that's something that's going on to overload.
Right.
And
that's how we got into it, because it was all the talking about the overload.
Well, they didn't. They were talking around, but they didn't use the word overload.
Yeah.
And in a way, I didn't either because I didn't have time. But I'm just telling. We're chatting.
No, I mean me and you were talking. Yeah, I mean, me and you were talking about it in reference to what they were talking about.
That's right.
Yeah. So, anyways, we should move on because I want to get some of these other people's calls in.
Oh, sure.
But David, I always enjoy talking to you. You know, stop by the bench sometime, or we'll get together. Lynn Andrews is talking over at Phoenix on Monday night.
Uh huh.
So whatever, come over there, or we'll see you around.
We'll see. As I said, I was kind of out of it for about 6 weeks because I couldn't stay back in my body, and then now I've been grounding, and as a matter of fact, my sleep patterns have completely changed, and I've gotten grounded, and it's like I've stepped out of one phase into another, and there's all this stuff that I picked up on during that time. See, I haven't tranced regularly for a long time, so it's like the universe says you are going to, and so I would just like put into a trance-like state. Well, you know, I resisted it, I couldn't do anything. It kept sending me back in. And, of course, I got a lot of notions. For one thing, now it's very likely that if we can pull it together, Norman and I want to move up to the Russian River.
Oh.
And I don't know how we're going to do it or whether we can do it, but we're talking about it, since just going up there, getting a place and living there.
Well, whatever. Do stay in touch and come over for dinner anytime.
All right.
Okay, thanks, David.
Au revoir.
Bye. Hello?
That should tell you something, Dr. Beter.
Well, Bob, I must congratulate you. I think you blew yourself out. That was probably the best show, or at least the worst.
Hey, it was an awesome show.
Oh, man.
I'm just putting my voice on the record. You're taping this. You got the tape, right?
Yeah.
I just want to put it on the record, and I agree with the callers. It was an awesome show.
Yeah, except the one lady said it all. She goes, I hope I never hear this Bob Dobbs again. She goes, you're like Buckley, man. You just will use words to brainwash people.
And I agreed with her.
I just damn...
But what are we to against so many?
Right, I just damn straight. That's right. Well, Mark Free called. He was trying for an hour to get through. And,
on the show.
And he said, you know, I had some of that stuff laying around at my house and that you sent me Bob literature, and my friends were reading it, and they were going, this is disinformation. And Mark goes, it sure is. Mark said that, and I says, yeah, but it's satire. And I says, well, yeah, Bob's a manipulative satire.
Who said it? He said it.
Yeah, Mark said it to them. Oh, it's satire. And I says, well, it's a little more complex than that, but that's a good way to put it. But you can't just, like, chalk it off. Oh, it's okay to be disinformation if it's satire.
Yeah, and then you use the word manipulative satire.
Right, and he says, I still haven't gotten a good definition of that. And I says, well, call up next time and ask him, because...
Yeah.
There's definitely a need for that. Many people reiterate that.
Okay, so I suppose you're getting calls, eh?
I've gotten 4 calls, and Dave Worcester's the 4th one, and he went on for 30 minutes about the history of his life, so we've got some great stuff there.
Oh, that's good, good, good. Yeah, we're getting Dave all worked up.
Yeah.
He said some nice things about me today, so that was good.
That was great, man. That shut Bob up. I says, man, what... Yeah, Dave was saying what Dave was doing was what I discussed with Mark, which was great, and I kept using you as the analogy. I says, well, how'd you like the show, Mark? He says, well, I wasn't really listening because I was concentrating on how I was going to word my question and getting through.
Yeah.
And I says, that's exactly how Bob didn't attend the McLuhan lectures. He would go and not participate at all so that he could get it all. And that's what Dave eventually did, because he kept trying at the beginning, didn't get through. He says, this show's too good. I'm just going to listen. I can't concentrate on dialing and what I'm going to say. I just want to listen. Dave said that, and it's all pulling full circle. And then all of a sudden you go, well, when's Dave going to call? And he goes, well, he woke up out of his trance, like, whoa, I better call in now.
In other words, that's great that Dave's getting into it, and he actually appreciated my show. Usually he has a little bug to pick with me, but he actually got into it today.
Exactly, because he stopped trying to get through and call.
And then he was enjoying it so much, he had to be taken out of his dream.
Right.
To work. Dave, where the fuck are you? We need your wrap-up, you know?
And at 6:05, he called up and he says, who is this on the phone?
What's 6:05?
Well, at 6:05 is when the McLuhan started. Well, about 6:08. The McLuhan and Edwin Newman started. David played that for an hour.
And you're saying Dave Worcester called?
Called me at like 6:10, actually, and said, who is this? And I goes, well, it's McLuhan. He says, he sounds like he's in trance. If you listen to that interview again, Bob, there's these pauses between what McLuhan says. He goes, the medium is the message.
Yeah. And so Dave was amazed that McLuhan was doing what he does, conscious mediumship.
Exactly.
So it was quite a day for Dave Worcester.
Yeah.
Okay, and you got all that stuff on tape. That's great.
Yeah, it was great.
Back after. Well, that's good, Jared. So that's all. I just wanted to drop in. We're going out now. And
how long is Furry Lynn? Is it 460 minutes? Do you remember?
Yeah, I don't know if it's 90, but it's 4 sides. You know, no, it's 8 sides. It's 4 tapes.
That's what I mean. 4 60-minute tapes, or do you know?
I can't tell.
You can't tell because
I remember.
What you want to do? We'll do the first hour, and then you'll do an hour and a half next time.
Right. The let me see. That show was no more than 4 hours long. So I would say there must be 60-minute tapes.
Right. So we'll start a series, and we'll do the first hour.
Yeah. Just check the first one.
Yeah.
But that's a good series.
Isn't that good to introduce to David? Because then. You know, I just introduced the idea. I says, hey, why don't you have him on the 22nd and play some Furry Lynn? And he says, okay.
Yeah, no, Furry Lynn is great, and that's that'd be perfect, because then you could have that for 4 more shows, and we got nothing else to play anyway, so we'll play 4 hours of that each time.
Each time, and then you do an hour and a half. It's much better with you an hour and a half. Did you notice how the first 2-3 calls were just like, oh, the best?
Yeah.
Because there was no pressure.
Yeah.
And I even apologized to Dave Lister. I says, David Porter doesn't want to rush you, Dave, you know, because it's you. I said, in the future, we should do a show where it's just you and Bob for an hour so there's no rushing.
Right.
Because he understood that, but it's just, you know, it always seems he gets in at the end and then David has to hurry him up.
Right. Well, I'm glad we hurried up because he does tend to go on a little bit too long, and it's good to put the pressure on Dave. He's got to learn how to say it faster.
Right, right. Well, that's a good point. I see that. That's good, too.
And also, we got him now. He repeated a point he made several shows ago about the quadrillions a second. Now, it's good to have him repeating things because then we see what Dave is talking about.
Right,
coming
good.
Back, we're getting enough of him on tape to reiterate a theme, his continuity.
Well, when the fires break out in New York City, due to all those people believing Walter Boehart's smoking banana peels, I want you out on that street grabbing your crotch, Bob.
Oh, you know what I'll be doing?
What?
You're watching the live TV saying, burn, baby, burn. It's bigger, as Dave Worcester pointed out.
That's good.
That's what Worcester was talking about. That was pretty amazing. That was really showing the organic nature of television.
Yeah, and also Dave loved the fact that you called McLuhan a street person.
Yeah.
That guy, Arcarita, goes, man, are you trying to say something against black people?
No, Dave Porter said that? Or
no, Dave Worcester.
He liked that.
He loved how you said McLuhan was a street person, and then Dave went into saying, I'm a street person, too.
Yeah. Well, who was it? Somebody called him and said, why are you knocking McLuhan?
I know, because you, yeah, that was another black guy.
Yeah, I got a lot of black callers today.
Great. It was such a great thing, and I mean, it really, you made a great stab at...
Well, it came about four times to listen to that show.
And you know what? You made a great stab at Roy. If he doesn't play this show, he's a fool, because you say, just like he broke Terrence McKenna, he could break me. But the great thing is that was community-oriented radio to the max. Man, there's a 23-year-old rich black dope dealer who's going to be on TV! And, you know, it was all...
That's Carla. She proved my point. Yeah, let's turn off the TV so the guy doesn't get on.
It zoomed in on the basic community, not just out in the,
yeah,
you know,
abstraction.
Abstraction, exactly. So he says, you're like an abstract painting. Well, that's pretty, yeah. I was staring at a Jackson Pollock yesterday. I see a Bob spelled in there.
Yeah. Well, he said abstract painting, but then we countered it with the...
The calls, Bob.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll get off the line and let you take more calls. and you're little Jerry from the Porter family. Do you like that little bit?
Yeah, this is what is it? Bill's got a radio station. And you're analyzing the Bill Mitchell phenomenon. That was too much. But Bill's going to start a new radio station, FUBC. And I'm closing out my conversation with Bob Dobbs here on FUBC.
Okay, well, that's it. And, I explained why Bill didn't become Rush.
Yeah, that was fabulous. I like when you had the plea. Well, somebody from the bench call in, Ned, come on.
I want some community representation here. Okay. Talk to you later, then.
Thanks for calling, Bob.
Okay, bye.
Hello?
Jerry.
Yeah.
Walter.
Hi, Walter.
Hey, how are you? We just had breakfast in Santa Monica. I've been calling you last night.
Oh, my God. Bob was on for an hour and a half this morning.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. It was one of his best shows ever, too.
Where about? On radio?
On KPFK.
Oh, no kidding.
I don't believe it.
Too bad. That's what, did you take the phone off the hook or something?
Did I take the phone off the hook?
Because I was calling you. I was busy all the time.
That's because we give my number out.
Oh, I see.
And people call in.
Oh, I see.
I'm glad you got through. Why don't you come down to the bench? Are you doing anything around 3?
Where's the bench?
Well, what's your plan?
I don't know.
Hello? Hello?
Hi, Jerry.
Yes?
It's time to talk.
Hello?
Mr. Fulka?
Yes?
This is Roberta Hamilton.
Yes?
Jeannie gave me your phone number.
Okay.
I hope you don't mind.
That's all right.
Anyway, I've been on the show with Roy a couple of times and whatnot over the hemp plant. And I heard this morning Bob Dobbs talking that his wife was doing something, and I missed his phone number.
Well, the best thing you could do is write your question down, whatever correspondence you want to do, and send the letter to me, and then I will forward it to him.
Well, he gave his phone number out.
That's this number.
Oh, it's this number.
Yeah, this is the number he gave out. This is the.
For God's sakes. Okay.
Yeah, this is the best way to communicate with him.
Okay, so what I wanted to do is communicate with his wife. Number one, I'm a professor emeritus from UCLA, and I did some work with the oil and the hemp plant and stuff, and. I would like really to contact her.
Okay, her name is Carolyn, and all you need to do is address it to her, a letter, and then put it in an envelope and send the whole thing to me, and on that envelope put 29 cents, and I'll forward it on to her.
Okay. Would you give me the address?
24...
So there's no other way to get in touch.
No, that's the best way to start it off. I hate to... sounds so, protective, but let's just start it that way.
Sure, fine.
And did you hear the show?
I sure did. Talked about him.
And what did you think?
I thought it was very interesting.
Oh, good.
Amazing, in fact.
Great. And you heard the McLuhan, too?
Yes, I did.
Oh, great.
So, the KPFK is really an astonishing station.
Oh, yeah.
And I really enjoyed it from one end. I wish I had a tape of the whole thing.
Well, hopefully Jeannie taped it, and you can get them through her, and if not, I'll give her copies, and you can get them through her.
Oh, good. I don't think she did tape it, because she wasn't aware that you were on this morning, I told her.
Oh, great.
And so maybe if you do give them to her, I'll have a chance to really...
I will. I'll give her copies.
A lot went by me so fast.
Yep, it's something you can re-listen to many times.
I'm sure. I'm really sure of it. But the main thing is, recently I was invited to go to Hawaii because the University of Hawaii is having a big to-do about the hemp plant, and they're very interested in regrowing it in place of the sugar that's just left. And a lot of the big wigs are beginning to listen over there.
Great.
Isn't that fantastic?
So that is.
Dwight Kondo sent me I got a lot in the mail this morning from him. I wasn't able to go because I had a family problem, but I did send them my speech, and they read it on a video, so which is good.
Well, send some of that information to introduce yourself to Carolyn. That will be good.
Oh, all right.
Okay.
No problem, and thank you for talking with me. And,
thanks a lot.
I'll get this letter off to her.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello?
Hi, Jerry. It's Philip.
Hi, Phil.
My third agent. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Harry. This is of global theater concern. Marshall McLuhan said clothes are extension of skin, shoes are extension of foot. What's this Le Show an extension of?
Obviously the phone at this point. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was enjoying the...
No, this isn't Bob, but who's calling?
Oh, my name is Jeff Hutner. I used to publish a thing called The Paradigm Digest, and I happened to have heard of me that morning.
Yeah, we're glad you tuned in.
Yeah,
how did you find out about it, first of all?
Pardon me?
How did you find out about it?
It was just, random. I happened to have a pinched nerve, and I've been up at very strange hours.
Well, that's great. Did you hear the Marshall McLuhan part?
Yes, I did.
And so you heard the whole 2.5 hours?
Yeah, well, pretty much, yeah. I mean,
okay.
I thought he's one of the more amazing guys I've ever heard talk.
Well, he's definitely the most amazing person I've ever met. But your name's Jeff?
Jeff Hutner, H-U-T-N-E-R.
Yeah, Jeff, what attracted you, basically? I mean, it's easy for people like to say, you know, he's the most amazing guy. I mean, mm-hmm. Do you have any specifics you can say?
Well, I mean, I think that because of his, I just think he's got such a broad perspective and also insight into, kind of the world that we're entering that, I certainly want to read his book, and I want to, get to know more about it.
Yeah, well, that's great, Jeff. Let me suggest, first of all, do you have a paper and pencil?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm interested in the work that he's doing on plants.
Right. Tell me about your magazine a little first.
Well, what I used to do was, I don't do it anymore because I kind of got burned out doing it, and I did it for a year. I had a quarterly publication that basically focused on, new ideas that were coming through in business or in science or in the arts.
And you were published out of L.A.?
Yeah.
And this was only 1 year.
Yeah, I did it for a year, and I've just recently finished up my third edition of a book that's called the L.A. Bargain Book, which is just kind of a little resource book.
Oh, I see.
That people can use and save money and time.
Right, because you might be interested. I don't want to promote selling things and all that.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, all this stuff does cost a little. Bob has two CDs.
Oh,
they're
really?
Both available at Tower.
Oh, really?
They're under the artist producers for Bob. And the title is called Bob's Media Ecology. And the second one's Bob's Media Ecology Squared. Now, the first one, actually, it's essential to get the liner notes. So you'll get the liner notes in the four pages that I send you.
Okay.
Because that's really essential reading. But there's a dialogue I did with Bob that's 17 pages long called Entertainment Sucks. So,
wow.
Eventually, I'd love for you to read that because get some feedback being a publisher. Because Mondo 2000 expressed interest and they never printed it. Gray Areas was about to print it. It's dangerous stuff. I mean, people, you know,
yeah.
Not to, you know, hoik it up too much, but I think it's really a great article. And I mean, the Weekly should be covering this guy, and we're gonna do it now probably every other month. We've been going every other month on David's show for three or four times, and I think hopefully the rest of the year we'll be doing it. And
great.
Be very interesting because we're going to be playing Bob's radio show called Furry Lint. Furry Lint in four parts. So on January 22nd, it'll be the first hour of a four-hour radio show, and then he'll be on for an hour and a half.
What time will that start?
That'll be 6 to 8:30 a.m. on January 22nd.
Right.
Yeah, so I highly encourage you to tune in. Now, have you ever read Marshall McLuhan?
Years ago, yeah.
Oh, I see. And have you ever read Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce?
I can't say I've read it. I've been through it, also years ago.
I see. Well, in the meantime, I do suggest maybe skimming through a couple of those.
Right. I do have the Mandela Bookstore. You know, those guys are good friends of mine, and I just told them about him and gave me a number.
Oh, yeah. I go over to Mandela all the time. I go see Jeffrey Hill there.
Yeah.
Yeah, have you seen him talk at all?
I haven't seen him. I saw his book and I reviewed it in the Digest.
Oh.
And I like him a lot. He's a good guy.
And your magazine was called Paradigm Digest?
New Paradigm Digest.
If you want, if you got a good issue or two that you would, you know, share, I could just trade you. You could send me those and then I'll send you Entertainment Sucks.
Well, what I've got is, I'm waiting, actually, to get back my original copies because I sent them to a guy in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've actually... The only thing I may have is, like, the first issue.
Well, whatever, you know, I'm just saying...
Yeah, I can take a look at
you know, we'll stay
online,
in,
otherwise I'll just send
yeah,
it.
Yeah, just stay in touch, you know, and let me know what sort of reaction you have to four pages. But, again, like, really appreciate you responding. And
yeah, well, I mean, you know, you don't hear too many voices like his on the air.
You don't, and it's sad that Roy... Do you listen to Roy Tuckman?
Yeah.
It's sad Roy hasn't played more. Roy played him once, and Roy should be playing him once a week. He should have him on live once a week because the guy can talk about Mellothion to Christian Murdy to May Brussels to everything.
Right.
He is definitely the eclectic mishmash of everything Roy's ever played
right.
And ever will play.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing the breath that the guy has.
It is.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
He lives in Toronto?
No, he's all around, but he did a show in Toronto for 4 years.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
All right, well, good. I'll get this stuff out to you. And then...
Jeff, I appreciate it again, and I look forward to you, the envelope, so I can pass on some more info to you.
All right, I appreciate it. I'll get out tomorrow.
Great, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Hello?
I'm Terry Bob Dogg.
Hi, you've reached the right line. My name is Jerry, and how long of the show did you hear, or how much of the show did you hear yesterday?
About all of it.
All of it? Did you hear the McLuhan, too?
Yeah.
What sort of reaction did you have? Okay.
I'm interested in the effects of the electronic media on physiology.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you come about studying that?
I'm in, my field is neuropsychology.
I see.
And I sort of got into it from the EM, the electromagnetic field end of it and all that stuff.
And did you just stumble on the show, or did you see it listed in the weekly, or what?
I just stumbled on it.
Huh.
Random. Yeah.
Are you a regular KPFK listener?
Yeah.
Have you heard Bob before?
Never have. No.
Well, he's been on a lot, and make sure you mark he's on January 22nd again, because it's actually people like you that we really want to dialogue with him, and since he'll be on for an hour and a half on the 22nd of January, you got a chance there, especially early on at 7, to carry on for 10 or 15 minutes, you know, and ask him specific things.
Does he have a book?
Yeah. Do you have a pencil and paper? I'll give you some information.
Go ahead.
What's your name?
Pat Smith.
Pardon me?
Patrick Smith.
Oh, Patrick. What specifically did you hear him say that led you to believe that he could offer you something in that light, you know, or talk about the subject?
I guess, you know, it's just, I've been talking to people, my circle of friends, about how the electronic media is changing what we are, from my point of view.
Right.
That it's,
how long have you been talking about that?
A couple of years.
And what first started you thinking that?
There's some research that's looking at chemistry and brain activity, electrical activity of the brain when somebody's plunked down in front of a TV as opposed to doing other activities. That was probably my initial kind of insight, hey, what's happening here? And then there was a Larry King show on electromagnetic fields, and that got me going on that. Some countries have really taken that kind of research to heart. In Sweden, for example, they're totally redoing all their electrical wires, you know, their big power transformer stations and everything. They're changing insulators on them because there's some real consistent patterns of disease and aberrant behavioral patterns with people by proximity to these things. So I think there's a lot in there at that level as well. And
have you ever read Marshall McLuhan?
Yeah, but it's been a long time.
Have you ever read Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce?
I went down yesterday to get a copy, and I was looking through it, and I asked myself the question, could I get through this? And I'm not sure if I can or not.
So you didn't buy it?
No, I didn't. But
yeah, well, that you would definitely be scared away if you did that on first. But it is the kind of book that's great to have by the bedside and just read one line every once in a while. But it's definitely...
Stream of consciousness?
It's stream of consciousness, but it's really beyond that. I mean, Ulysses is like one of the first novels that brought about, you know, the technique of stream of consciousness. But Finnegan's Wake is beyond that in many ways. It's I think it would be important for you to have just to because of what you're studying, because there's so many parallels, but whatever. I mean... there's a book by Marshall McLuhan that you could find cheap if you search at used bookstores. It's called War and Peace in the Global Village. And it has excerpts throughout it from Finnegan's Wake. And that might help you, you know.
Give me some reference.
Yeah, that helps. And Marshall's other book, The Medium and the Massage, I highly recommend. And Laws of Media, I would say that's a must for you. The Global Village, these are all in print, and you'll get the list, and, you know, check some of that stuff out.
How'd you get into this?
Well, I met Bob in 88, and just accumulated about 22 hours of dialogues with him that I hope to get out in a book someday, or just keep them going on in access to people, because it's really the access that people have to him that's important, because he can sit there and just talk one-on-one with someone, but it's really the important ingredient is the encounter, you know, and you don't have to be. I mean, that's why I encourage you to participate, because you come from one angle. Now, if the woman calls and says, you know, the blacks are fighting the blacks here and the blacks are fighting the blacks in Africa, that's great. That's another angle. It doesn't matter what topic you bring up. You know, he's such a big picture view person that he can talk about it all. And it never ceases to amaze me how after the KPFK shows, people call me up and right away say, this guy seems so legit, you know, and it is because he is. But, you know, he often brings up things people don't want to hear about, and he often talks in terms that are so far above people they don't get it, and that's fine too. You know, he's not purposely trying to be intellectual. He's just trying to express thoughts and communicate. So one of the key calls yesterday was when the woman called up and says, this guy's, you know, using big words like Buckley does to just brainwash us, and I'll never listen to Bob Dobbs again. And that was great, because it's I think it's pretty easy to get swooped into Bob's world and just start listening. That's good. I'm not fighting it, but I think that's proof that he's full spectrum, that he's going to upset people too. And that's because he really tries to attain what's called suspended judgment, which it's pretty impossible not to have a point of view. You know, so I think it's important to study the effects, and that's the other thing he does. And that's the one thing we never did with electricity. We started at word of mouth, and we talked to each other. Then we went into the print medium, and we started to write letters. And then we got into telegraph, telephone, television, radio, computer, and it subsumed humanity. And we never turned it off to study the effects. And what we need to do is have a media fast. And it's not because we're anti-TV or anti-electricity. We're pro-awareness. But we need to just turn it off for 2 days or 2 weeks or something, study the effects, and then turn it back on. But, you know, you're going to kill people by it. You know, you're into that world. You know, if you turn off all electricity in the world for a day, there's people who are dependent on electricity, and they're going to die. So, and it also is not something that should be like a no smoking day for a day, you know. It's got to be something that happens because everybody wants it to happen. It's not because there's a group of people who want to do this.
I echo what the host said at one point. Of, you know, I've done that. I'm not anti-media either, electronic media either, but it's sort of like the analogy of the fish are swimming and they don't really know they're in water. They don't understand how the water affects their world, you know?
Because they've never been out of it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, and it's a consciousness question, an awareness issue, and there are some really interesting physiological correlates to what's being expressed by Bob Dobbs in terms of the potential impact of the electronic media on behavior and, you know, the implications for what is, you know, where is humankind headed. It just all swirls together from my point of view.
That's a good observation, Patrick, because that's indeed what it is that we're subsumed by subsumed by electricity. And people don't even realize what it would be like without TV for a day. You know, you could have little stations around and have all the people who watch Rush Limbaugh and all the people who watch The Simpsons go to these little stations and talk to each other. And they would be talking, I remember, you know, because they can't watch it that day or that week. They'd all sit around and talk about, I remember when The Simpsons did this, blah, blah, blah. And there would actually be some communication happening. And it would be remarkable. There would be people going through withdrawals. I've got to have a set. You know? And I mean, that right there, just to concentrate on one simple experiment like that, would be astounding what the results that would happen. You know? It'd give people jobs, too. They could be station managers, you know?
That's right. We need caterers to bring in food.
Caterers to bring in food, everything. I mean, it's endless.
Okay, good. Now, the information that you're sending me, is that going to include any... do you have any, like, ongoing forums of people getting together and talking about this stuff or anything like that?
Well, you can call me anytime. What I really recommend is after you get some of that, give me a call. But yeah, we meet constantly in Venice down at a bench, second bench south of Dudley on Oceanfront Walk, and I always have a sign up. Actually, one of my signs says electricity killed humanity, and you can come by there anytime. Or actually on Saturdays and Sundays from 3 to 6 we're usually there. And give me a call if you're, you know, intending to come by, and I'll be sure to be there. And other than that, there's a lot of lectures that I can recommend of people talking about things similar like this. Jeffrey Hill's lecture series at Mandala and at I think Varum's at Pasadena.
Where's Mandala? What is
Mandala? What part of town are you in?
I'm about 60 miles east of L.A.
East? Oh. Mandala's a bookstore in Santa Monica.
It's only a little bit over an hour.
But. Yeah. But actually, Wednesday night, he has a lecture there. And, I mean, he's not associated with Bob, but there's a lot of people that touch on
right.
William Irwin Thompson. Have you read any of his books?
That's one of the books I wrote down.
Yeah, I would check out him a little too. Just stay in touch and let me know. You know, if you want to come over sometime, if you're coming into LA,
right.
You know, for a day, give me a call and come over. And I mean, I've got hours of videos and audios of Bob that we could just sit around, and that, I mean, that's, I'm always looking for people just to discuss this, and I can have a couple of my friends come over. One of my friends is a historian of the future, and he's dialogued with Bob a lot, so he has interesting concepts too.
Alright, Jerry, sounds great.
Okay, Patrick, thanks for calling. I look forward to your envelope.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Hello?
Yes, sir. Jerry, please.
Speaking?
Jerry, this is Jeffrey Hill.
Hi, Jeffrey. How's it going?
Very well. How are you?
Oh, good. Did you hear the show?
Yes, I did, actually.
The whole 2.5 hours?
No, actually, I made a mistake. I was actually staying at a friend's in Santa Monica, and I got up at 7 to... For some reason, I had in my mind it was like from 7 to 8:30, so I only recorded that portion, and I guess I missed the Marshall McLuhan part of it.
Oh, okay. Well, I can get you a copy of that. That's no problem. So, but did you hear the 7 to 8:30?
Yeah, I was very fascinated.
While it happened, or?
No, actually, I'm not a morning person, so I just got up and recorded it.
Right, you recorded it, and then you listened to the whole hour and a half.
Yes, I did.
And what did you like or dislike about it, or?
No, I was very fascinated by it.
Yeah.
What happened was actually when I actually plugged in the recording part of it, the first 2 or 3 minutes was the end of the McLuhan interview.
Yeah.
And later when I woke up, my friend and I started listening to the tape. And when she was listening to McLuhan, she started laughing because it sounded so funny to her. And then I started laughing also because he was
Well, you know, he was talking about the miniskirts and the mini...
Exactly.
All that stuff, and it just sounded so funny to both of us.
Oh, yeah, he's a Manipian satirist. He's...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's you tell, she tuned right in. That's what it's about. And McLuhan's funny.
Yes.
Yeah, most definitely.
So what happened was before I heard the rest of the Bob Dobbs thing, I started telling her about this conversation I had with a guy on a plane where I sat next to him and he was reading the Course in Miracles, and him and I started talking. You know what that is?
That, what's the the woman who wrote that? What's her name?
Oh, I don't even know if they know who wrote it. I think it was supposedly channeled through some...
Oh, okay, so I'm mistaken. This is another book. Okay, go ahead. I don't know much about it, but I...
Yeah, well, one of these New Age things.
Okay.
Anyway, so we had this conversation, and he started saying a whole bunch of shit that made no sense at all to me.
Right.
And yet he was seeming very, very intelligent.
Right.
I was telling her this story about this conversation, and after a while, I realized that he made no logical sense whatsoever. So I started playing this game with him without his knowledge. I started, rapping off a bunch of seemingly intelligent, logical nonsense to him, and then he was answering me.
Right.
And so we carried on this long conversation that had virtually no basis in reality whatsoever.
Uh huh.
And he didn't even know it.
Right.
But then eventually I confessed to him what I was doing, and then he just continued. As if I wasn't doing it.
That's called user's content. He was using the experience to his own, consciousness, sort of.
Yeah. Now, I didn't know much about her. If you told me anything ahead of time, I forgot. Now... you're Bob Dobbs, is that right?
Oh, no, I'm not Bob Dobbs.
Oh, you're not Bob Dobbs.
Oh, no.
Maybe you somehow got into this character or something.
Oh, no, that's not me at all. That's another person.
That's another person.
No, not me at all. It's not me being another person or channeling or anything. No, that... David Porter is the show. It's his show, and I produce and get guests on his show. Bob, I met in '88, and I've had him on David's show about 6 or 7 times now, and I have music people on David's show and interview them, sort of co-produce, and Bob is just one of those that I think. Well, he should be on Roy's show all the time because he pretty much spans the big picture view, you know? He can go from Alan Watts, Christian Murty, to May Brussel and the political thing, and to science and geography and arithmetic and everything. And he's pretty much a big picture view guy. I think you have aspects of that too. You know, your lectures that I've seen sort of, aren't just specifically. You're pretty general at times, and that helps, I think, because specializing sometimes is what they want us to do, so that they can polarize us better or keep us. Blinded into a certain category.
Is that his real name, Bob Dobbs?
I guess as real as you're going to get. Yeah, I'll bring you another booklet that he did this week. You're at a Mandala Wednesday, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll bring you the McLuhan Dialogues, which is a column he wrote for an ad... trade magazine, an advertising trade magazine in Canada, that they ask questions and he answers them in McLuhan light, as though McLuhan would answer them, because he was Marshall's archivist for many years, and very few people really understand McLuhan. They don't understand that he was a Manipian satirist. You know, that's why right off the bat you guys realize that, because you're laughing.
Right.
You know? And in as well, that's not to discount him, because, you know, humor is serious business. So Marshall had a lot to offer, and he was looking for someone to take the ball and run with it.
Yeah.
And that's what Bob's done.
Yeah. Well, that was my thought. Now, when I heard Bob Dobbs on the radio, then after McLuhan, you know, so much of it, even what he was doing, I mean, actually, I told my friend this story about this conversation I had on the plane before Bob Dobbs came on.
Yeah.
Then when he came on, then I realized, my God, you know, he sounds like a lot of what I was doing on that airplane interview.
Oh.
Was he serious about all of this stuff? I mean, my guess is that he's serious about some of it, and then some of it he's just like playing games with the public.
Well, I think the best way I describe that question, because I get it constantly, is that everything Bob says is 100% fake, made up, phony, and 100% true. So that's a hard question.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of question that, you know, if you're around on January 22nd when he's on the next time, and there's any way you can get up, ask him, you know, because that's the important thing about Bob's appearances on the radio, is that it's interaction with the listener.
I had several things, other things that crossed my mind. Is one thing, it seemed like kind of a, you know, if you can translate like deconstructionist architecture into communication, it seemed like that's what he was doing. In other words, just kind of extending communication and semiotics out to its ultimate conclusion, to where it eventually breaks down into this seemingly logical, non-logical, you know, point of interaction with one another, to where, and I was amazed with some of the questions that people were calling in on.
It was amazing. Jeffrey, are you in Santa Monica still?
Actually, no, I'm up in the mountains right now.
Oh, okay. So that is an amazing thing, because, first of all, let me go back a step and ask you, what is the deal when you compare it to deconstructionism? What exactly do you mean specifically by that? Because I don't even understand what is meant by deconstruction.
Well, what I had in mind was that it seems like he's, you know, kind of like taking McLuhan out further than where McLuhan went, in the sense that, you know, if everything is an extension of the body, and then if we extend so far to where we're so far removed. And then this goes into some of my own theory, you know, where I talk about originality and having lost participation and so forth. If we take things so far out away from the original source to where it's no longer connected, everything is deconstructed down to where we're just merely dealing in signs and symbols without necessarily saying anything anymore.
It's void of content.
Yeah. And yet, paradoxically, in the midst of seemingly saying nothing, people are calling in with these deep, profound philosophical questions about the meaning of life, seemingly getting some meaning out of it all. You know?
Right. In other words, you're saying in the midst of Bob pulling this deconstructive dialogue, that he's pulling some things out of people that may not have come out otherwise.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they seem to be very fascinating. I mean, they seem to be like, oh, wow, there's really some profound insight here. And in one sense, there is, but I don't think it's at the level that they think that it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like when you stretch something out as far as you can possibly go, it's like a rubber band that snaps back to the original.
Mm-hmm.
It almost forces people to participate, not in purpose, but in irony.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I think it makes a lot of sense. The only thing is I want to continue our conversation.
Yeah.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Yes.
This is Jerry.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm sorry about that interruption, but anyways, I wanted to stay on that just for a second. Excuse me, with your encounter with this gentleman on the airplane. Were you, in essence, doing sort of the same thing you think Bob was, or were you more or less sort of being a little, you know, I mean, were you experimenting with it, or were you sort of just seeing what you can get away with?
Can you hold just a minute?
Sure.
Sure thing. Thanks for waiting.
No problem.
So, you say, what was the question again?
The question's sort of like, and not in a derogatory sense, were you sort of like maliciously like a little kid seeing, wow, what can I get away with this guy, in an, you know, trying to study the effects sort of way, or were you sort of doing what Bob, do you think Bob was doing?
Well, I think I was doing what he was doing, in that this person I was talking with, and I've done this actually on a couple of other occasions.
I see.
Another occasion happened to be at this coffee shop I used to hang out in L.A., where there was an old Irishman, an old Catholic Irish that loved Irish literature, and in fact he used to quote James Joyce on a regular basis, and he would even recite Irish poetry and even recite some of Finnegan's Wake and so forth.
Wow, what's the guy's name?
Well, he's not really worth talking to unless you want to laugh.
But what coffee house is it?
What's that?
What coffee house is it?
It used to be the Pick Me Up. It's no longer there, but there's another coffee shop that it's in its place. But he lives in the neighborhood. He probably still hangs out there. At any rate, with both of these people in particular, what I was doing was that they would go on in these endless monologues about stuff that made no logical sense whatsoever, and then they would want me to engage with them in this nonsense. But to them, it made perfect sense because I suspect maybe there's some brain damage or something going on. I don't know what. At any rate, you know, since it made virtually no sense to me, I thought, well, there's no sense in answering them logically. I may as well join their game and answer them illogically.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, well, maybe this is the only way that I can actually enjoy this conversation rather than just being rude and say, listen, this makes no sense to me. I'd rather not talk about it. So I just literally began joining their game and talking like them, but even in a more exaggerated fashion, but in a way with words and complex ideations that sounded very profound, you see.
Uh-huh.
And they thought I was actually saying something when I wasn't saying a damn thing. And it was just fascinating to me to go on like this. In other words, what crossed my mind was that this is what's happening to communication today, is that, you know, we have so much emphasis on science, so much emphasis on communication and all of these technologies that seemingly advance communication, when in actuality it breaks it down to the most illogical and you know, kind of deconstructed form of communication, which is no communication at all.
Which is sort of the thought that electricity kills humanity.
Yes. Yeah.
But now, and then it flips into its opposite, which is sort of tetrad management, that in doing this, Bob comes out with the result is some of these people coming out and being completely human.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And you see, then another problem I have, not necessarily, well, I guess you could call it a problem depending on how you look at it. But I have a learning disability. And if complex phrases and words and sentences come into my brain too quickly, I can't process it. And so that's one of the reasons why some of this stuff makes no sense to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it just comes in so quickly, I can't process it. But if I take the time and go back and play it over, then I can, you know, break it down and see if it actually has a logical continuum.
Right.
But
so that's what you've done is listen to it once without no rewinding.
Yes, exactly.
Right, and you figured, well, if you had the time, you might go back.
Yes, yeah. In fact, I plan on it, yeah.
Oh, you do plan on it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and you see, part of the problem is that this is one of the diseases of
academia also. For example, I have a friend who's like a real genius when it comes to, you know, just really breaking down a lot of contemporary thought and especially in philosophy. But the problem is he doesn't know how to communicate. And he gets extremely frustrated that he cannot communicate. You know, if I go back and kind of like rewind or reread some of his material, then I could kind of like translate it for him. And the Bob Dobbs interview kind of reminded me of that to some degree, in that, you know, he's coming up with, you know, he's like spouting up all of these extremely complex things, like he said, tetrarch management and all of this kind of stuff, most of which I've never heard of before. But I'm sure that it exists either in McLuhanian thought or Bob Dobbian thought or whatever.
Well, yeah, actually I sent you a page on Tetrad.
Yeah.
It's a four-step process that Marshall and his son Eric talk about in the book called Laws of Media, and it's a four-step process of analyzing anything man-made, any man-made phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, just to casually throw that out to a general public audience, I thought it was really quite fascinating, with no introduction to the terms he was using or anything.
Oh, yeah, because he constantly says Secret Council of Ten in various terms that people... It just goes right by him fast.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of it. I think that then they call up and say, well, what does this mean? And then he has to talk about it. So it just strengthens his, like, rap on it, and he learns how to communicate more about what he's talking about.
Right, yeah.
So it's like a process.
But I think it's just fascinating. I mean, another thing that crossed my mind with it is I thought what a fun thing to do would be, like, for example, I imagine myself like having an interview with him, to where the two of us start, you know, rapping with one another about totally nonsensical stuff, and yet making it out to be a real, you know, serious form of intellectual debate.
Well, I could arrange that. I mean, Jeffrey, I think that's something we could consider, but I think maybe what you should do first is listen to the tape and then come up with some ideas and discuss them with me, and we'll set that up. That's no problem. I'd do it on my phone in a second. I'd love for that to happen. I think it would be real healthy. In fact, we could do it... you, him, and Phil, or we could just do you and Phil some night, and you and Bob some night. It doesn't matter. It's just that Bob would do it on the phone, and I have a speaker phone, so we could do that. But that's a welcomed, definitely. But just your whole approach, I think, maybe keeping in mind both aspects, the